go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Stand by a sec. Post in to help let some folks know, or let folks know what's going to be going on in the next few minutes. Ordinarily, we would start off with the prayer meeting Wednesday shtick, but we're going to take a pass on that this evening. And I know Kate's probably out there going, "Yay! I hate that nasty old preacher." We're going to take a pass on it for a very good reason. Oh, by the way, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, independent broadcasting, conversation radio, uninterrupted by commercial matter or pitches for buying gold now or bowling vacuum cleaners to pick up bowling balls off Swedish mattresses and then as well as herbal hair tonics that will grow hair on said bowling ball. This is not for-profit media. This is earnest, occasionally irreverent, independent broadcasting that is driven by listeners, for listeners, and is, in fact, for those of you who know and for those of you who don't, an effort more at community building than at broadcasting, insofar as broadcasting can be understood to be the profit-driven mess that it is on cable and on the terrestrial airwaves and so forth. So I hesitate to say excited because the story is just icky. Rather than excited, I would say that I am, pleased doesn't work either. Gratified? Maybe. The bottom line is that here in about 15 minutes, we're going to be talking to Carol Shuler. She will be live with us from Alabama, and we will be talking about the travails of her husband, Roger. While we spend a good bit of time here at the Horn and among the many members of the Horn family commune talking about the failures of the for-profit media, when the opportunity arises to do something about it, we like to do it. And by we, I mean all of us. Because it's the stories that we talk about here and the way that we help to spread them around and help them, as the saying goes, get legs, that makes the difference. And so, as we speak, an innocent man, Roger Shuler, has been incarcerated. He is a journalist. He is trained as a journalist. He is a practicing journalist. He is, I suppose you could say, he is an investigative journalist. He does journalism. And he does it in one of the hardest places to do it in the world. No, not Afghanistan, not Iran, not Russia. He does it in Alabama. And that it is incredibly difficult to do journalism in Alabama is proven by what Roger Shuler is going through even as we speak. Alabama is, well, you all know I spent the first 18 years of my life there. I'm not there anymore, obviously. And as a native-born Alabamian, I can tell you that it can be strange, it can be backwards, it can also be wonderful. But the power structures in the state of Alabama are deep and deeply entrenched. And they do not like being challenged. With that in mind, you may recall some of the things going back many years now that we have covered here on the Horn. The escapades of a former attorney general down there by the name of Troy King. The story of the family values, God-fearing, upstanding Christian Southern Baptist minister who was found dead of autoerotic self-asphyxiation involving sex toys that were illegal to possess in the state of Alabama, not to mention two wetsuits. When you think about the content of what Dr. Bill O'Brien just spent the last 2 hours talking about, and you compare that with what goes on in Alabama, it becomes pretty clear that we are talking about two very different worlds. One in which the rule of law obtains, and one in which, for instance, a generation or more ago, a man stood in the university doorway at the state university and declared, "Segregation now! Segregation yesterday, segregation today, segregation forever." George Wallace, on his attempt to keep people of color from being able to obtain an education at a public-funded university. Segregation, the civil rights, the Birmingham church bombing, the Bloody Sunday at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. These are all of a piece. It goes back to secession. It goes back to before secession. And it continues unto this very day. And this very day, a journalist by the name of Roger Shuler has been jailed by the self-important martinet of a circuit judge who has decided apparently that the law is meaningless. And we will be talking to Carol Shuler about everything that happened to Roger in the last few days. There's a big difference between bringing on an expert to talk about something and tell you what you ought to think about something, as opposed to bringing on someone who is an actual witness to unfolding events. This is the latter. I think when you hear from Mrs. Shuler, you will be, even understanding that we're talking about Alabama, you will be shocked. You will be horrified. And when you realize that some of the same players involved here go all the way back to the theft of the election, the gubernatorial election from Don Siegelman, the bigger picture will become much more apparent. And then hopefully, after we have had a conversation with Mrs. Schuller, we will have a conversation about how to deal with it, what to do with it. Our friend Matt Osborne, who we talked to on the phone the other night, Monday night, has helped to arrange all of this, and he has created a hashtag. He's actually on his way to the Schuller residence right now, where he is going to document and inventory the scene where Mr. Schuller was assaulted and beaten by uniformed members of local law enforcement there. He's also delivering relief supplies because Mrs. Schuller is largely under siege. So supplies have been gathered up, and Matt is on his way to the house right now to deliver those supplies. He has created a hashtag on Twitter that you can follow if you wish. The hashtag is OpSchuler, OpSchuler, OpSchuler. Roger Schuller at present is being kept he is presently incarcerated. He has had no bail hearing, no bond hearing. Habeas corpus apparently means absolutely nothing in the state of Alabama. The pleadings in the case are sealed, and so consequently there is a legal defense fund that has been created for Roger Schuller, the legal schnauzer. And if you go to osborneinc.com, you can find information about that. So I think we're going to have rather an interesting evening, and hopefully it will be an activist evening, because one of the failures, and there's been a lot of pontificating lately from certain corners about failures of the for-profit media, and yet no, never any mention of the for-profit aspect, because the person pontificating will be doing as much for-profiting as anybody at, say, the New York Times. One of the failures of the for-profit media, as far as my lights are able to discern, lies in the fact that it purports to be a cool recitation of the facts of a given incident or moment or event without suggesting a remedy, without suggesting action, without suggesting means of righting wrongs. There was a journalism outfit once upon a time whose motto wasn't it something like comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. Well, that doesn't obtain in today's for-profit media landscape. In today's for-profit media landscape, when you've got people who sit before television cameras and pull down millions of dollars a year, they're not going to tell you to get out of your seat and onto your feet and into the street. They're going to tell you to stay tuned. We'll be back right after this ad for Preparation H, which you badly need, because you've been sitting on your ass watching us talk to you from the electric TV box for most of your life. We'll be back. Right? So, as you know, if you are a long-time listener, we take the idea of conversation radio very seriously here. To say that we do interviews is not entirely accurate, and to say that it is deliberately structured to get out a particular angle is wholly inaccurate. The idea is to get at the essence of an event or an issue by means of that thing that apparently, supposedly, separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, that is, human speech. And so now, at 15 minutes past the hour, it's 15 after 6 here in the Eastern Time Zone, it's 15 after 5 in the Central Time Zone, we are joined by Carol Schuler, calling from Alabama. Mrs. Schuler, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Yes, I'm here.
I thank you, first of all, very kindly for taking time to have this conversation. I know that it is probably difficult under the circumstances with which you are dealing, but you have my sincere thanks and that of the Horn Family Commune for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us, just as a matter of background, tell us a little bit about you and your husband's work at the Legal Schnauzer blog. You are one of the most read legal blogs in the country, right?
Yes, I believe it was rated as in the top 50 independent legal, law blogs in the country as of last year. I can't remember what the outfit was out of Chicago that named that, but Roger did a post about that. But, yeah, I think he was right. We were ranked 37th. And but all the others were had academic backing or with the law firms and all that. It was like I don't hardly think there was any that was just totally independent. Called it independent. They called them independent, but they really weren't that independent. He was one of the. He was about the only one of them truly independent ones.
So how did you come into this? It's my understanding Roger has a journalism background.
Yes, he did. He does. He graduated in 78 from the University of Missouri, Columbia, the journalism school there. And he worked for, he came here right after graduation and started working with the Birmingham Post-Herald, the daily morning paper here,
mm-hmm.
and worked there for 11 years. And about that time, you know, we'd met and decided we were going to get married, and so he decided he wanted to have something a little bit more normal hours and whatnot, and so he got a job at UAB in the publications area in their office and stayed there a good 18, 19 years before he was cheated out of his job there in 2008.
And the Legal Schnauzer blog was born when?
It was in the previous year, in 07. And our legal travails kind of started up in, we got hit with a lawsuit in 2000, based on some neighbor problems, property-related things that had happened in the previous year in 99 and whatnot, and we got hit with a bogus, you know, lawsuit, and anyway, it just drained us of all sorts of funds, you know, hiring a lawyer, you know how it is when you get sued, you know, you don't know what, have to find somebody to represent you. We didn't know anything
right.
at that time. So that's from 2000, it sort of like that's when it sort of went on, and I think it ended up going to the actual civil trial in 2004, a jury trial, and Roger was representing himself at that point because we'd gone through a couple lawyers, it was kind of a mess. But that was in 2004 that happened.
But it didn't, it obviously did not in any way curtail your and Roger's dedication to trying to expose graft and corruption inside the state of Alabama, which,
right.
from where I stand, Carol, is pretty rich pickings.
Yes, it is. It's very rich pickings. I was like, we had no idea. We were like lambs to the slaughter or something. I don't know. It's like, well, like most people, you know, you think, oh, I mean, you know, courts are good, and now you know we got, you know, due process and all the stuff that you're supposed to talk that, you know, we have, and you know the judges, you know, all, you know, up and up, it was a rude awakening.
Yeah, all that stuff that you expect to exist when you get all warm and fuzzy at the 4th of July parade, and
exactly
the stuff they teach in civics class about
exactly it was supposed to be, and because then most people, I bless them, you know, maybe never have any kind of dealings with any kind of civil arena, civil courts and everything, and I hope they don't. I wouldn't wish it on hardly anybody. I mean, you know, like we're just like, you know, just ordinary people and just had no dream, had any inkling that we would ever be involved in anything like this. And, but like I said, once we had that, the civil trial occurred in 04, and anyway, we decided that, you know, we needed to let people know. It's like a public service, like to let know that, you know, this can happen to you too, kind of thing.
Sure.
I mean, if it can happen to us, it can happen to anybody. In 07, started the Legal Schnauzer blog to just, you know, write about our story, plus the Don Siegelman story was going on, and Rich Scrishy and Paul Miner over in Mississippi, and just, you know, there were some other things locally, I mean, here in the state and also nearby state that were, you know, to write about as far as how warped and messed up the legal system was. And so, it wasn't just about us. We were just trying to expose that.
Right, and going back to the Siegelman issue, of course, that election victory was essentially stolen from Don Siegelman by virtue of some just nasty, dirty, old-fashioned electoral flim-flam down in Baldwin County, Alabama, a place I'm
absolutely
familiar with.
It was, absolutely.
And Roger wrote about it.
He did. Probably more, I mean, more than anybody. I know there, you know, I mean, well, without question, he wrote about it more than anybody. And, you know, understood it better, you know, and understood the law. Like I said, having to represent himself and strike a jury and all this. I mean, he discovered, I don't know, I mean, sometimes, you know, lawyers, they don't, you know, represent even their own clients. Like properly and everything. Like you think they're supposed to be like, oh, you know, people watch, you know, Perry Mason and all that kind of
stuff. Yeah, it ain't Matlock.
I wish it was. I'm hopeful that there are, you know, maybe some, but I mean, just so many aren't, you know, and that's the bad thing, just our personal experience. I mean, you know, I'm not like, you know, painting all of them the same brush. I mean, I hold out hope, keeping hope alive that there are some.
Well, at present, you are, I mean, I think it goes without saying that at present, you are badly in need of a couple of good ones.
Yeah. So that's why I'm, you know, really like keeping hope alive, big time, because we're badly in need of, you know, a couple of really good attorneys.
Well, let's go to sort of the crux, well, at least a little background on the crux of the matter. Your husband, among other things, reported on allegations that, and for those who don't know or have been in the Deep South, one cannot get elected to office, one cannot get elected dog catcher in a place like Alabama without trumpeting one's Christian family values.
Values, yes, absolutely.
And part of having upstanding God-fearing Christian family values is that you most assuredly have to despise the gay people, right?
Oh yes, the gays or you know, anybody
liberals
be unfaithful. Oh, liberals, of course, that goes without saying. And then, you know, anybody would dare to, you know, be unfaithful in any way, and or certainly anybody that would, you know, dare have, you know, I mean, consider having an abortion. That's just like, you know, just all the worst thing that you could possibly do. And you know, just saying, and all that whole down the line, you know, the family values stuff they spout.
So,
and, you know, if they're true about it, that's one thing. But I mean, I'm not saying it's good, you know, obviously talk against gays and stuff. But I mean, how you live your life is one thing. But I mean, but being hypocritical, that's
precisely. It's not. It's the hypocrisy, and that brings us to a former Attorney General of the state of Alabama, by the name of. Pryor, is it?
Yes, Bill Pryor.
Bill Pryor, who was
Bill Pryor.
Yeah, who was a dedicated. I think the phrase back in the bad old days of 2001 to 2009 was a loyal Bushy.
Yeah.
He was a loyal Bushy in the onslaught against Don Siegelman, among other people. Correct.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm, he was.
And
he really drove that home.
Yes, he did. And along the way, of course, he opined about, well, he's reminiscent of a man who's running for governor right now in Virginia, a man by the name of Ken Cuccinelli, who, among other things, wants to manage other people's sex lives.
Oh, okay.
And, I mean, you know, shake the tree, one of them falls out, right?
Yeah, it's tongue-in-cheek, of course. You know, I can't stand that kind of people. I mean, you know, it's like, whose business is it anyway to, like, tell
right,
them?
But Bill Pryor was not at all a shrinking violet when it came to speaking out about his traditional family values and how
absolutely
gay people were going to well, I mean, we've heard all the rhetoric. Everything right down to causing earthquakes.
You know, to blame for everything.
Right, and he tried to
cancel a Disneyland or Disney World trip. I can't remember which one.
That's the one. Yeah, he was one of those. He was one of those. Bill Pryor was one of those weirdos who protested against gay days at Disney World. Is that it?
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. They had a family vacation planned, and when he heard he was going to be gay day, well, then oh my goodness, then they canceled it because it was just. So egregious. So
what will we tell the children?
Exactly. What will we tell the children? The children. Yeah.
So in return for his loyalty, George W. Bush nominated Bill Pryor to become a constitutional Article 3 sitting federal district judge in the state of Alabama. Correct?
I believe that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he is sitting on the federal bench at this point in time?
Yes, he's a federal judge. Mm-hmm. He has influence. Actually, he has his office. We were thinking he had his office over in Atlanta, but it turns out he's got his office here, right here in the federal courthouse downtown where Roger and I have had a couple of cases. So he's got his finger in any number of pies, as far as the, ramrodding or, taking care of the Siegelman case and how many different other people in federal court, making it happen the way the Republican machine wants it to, be done.
Right.
He does.
So there he sits on the federal bench, and somehow or another, and you can maybe explain this better than I can, a certain photograph came to the attention of your husband, Roger.
It did. It did. We got wind of that and were able to track it down. The really reliable sources where it was investigated. It was actually investigated. I like that Roger wrote about it in his blog, but investigated by the ABI back in the 90s that he had. Actually, that's when it appeared on the web. On a website, Bad Puppies.
Yeah, I love the name of that. Badpuppies.com.
I know, I do too. I have to chuckle.
Kind of like the bad puppy versus the legal schnauzer. There's a.
Yeah.
Right. So this is
a print magazine before that in the 80s. It was in a four color magazine, from what we understand. And we've talked to numerous people who have seen that actual four color magazine in the 80s.
This photograph in question was of. Upstanding, God-fearing, family values-cherishing, traditional marriage-supporting, gay days boycotting Bill Pryor, totally naked in a magazine advertising for gay sex. Do I have it right?
Yes. It was targeted for the gay audience, and he was definitely of age. He was in college. He was kind of a young-looking guy, but we definitely have it on good authority he was in college.
So is it safe to say that your husband, Roger, ruffled a few feathers by writing about this and by publishing the photo?
Yeah, I think that would be safe to say. He most certainly did.
And would it also be safe to say that he published the photos in the interest of journalistic disclosure of unethical conduct?
Right. I mean, exactly.
I mean, there was nothing salacious or prurient about this. He was actually doing the job that the First Amendment charges the Fourth Estate with doing.
Exactly. I mean, because it was in the public's interest. I mean, they had a right to know that this judge that sits and takes, is paid by the taxpayers, and they're, with a federal, lifetime appointment, is sitting there, and he's got this in his background, which compromises him. I mean, when you have that kind of dirt, I mean, you know, I'm like, I mean, you know, hey, somebody wants to pose naked. I mean, that's their business. I mean, whatever. But I mean, but to turn around and then proceed to be, you know, just like conservative family values, hypocrite kind of thing, that's something else because it goes so contrary to what he espouses. And so that makes him vulnerable to be manipulated by, you know, by the Republican Party to say, hey, we've got this and you do what we say. And so he's in a compromised position. And I'm showing what kind of harm he's inflicted on how many people, you know, in the courts.
And of course, there's always, I can't, disclosure, I have never been nominated to the federal bench. I suspect I never will be. But I can posit, Carol, that when one is nominated to the federal bench, people ask questions like, prospective judge, are there any dirty pictures of you out there fully naked that may have showed up in gay sex trolling magazines in the 1980s?
Yeah, exactly. They ask that. They definitely ask those questions. And I have a pretty, you know, like I said, we would kind of like nail down the information exactly of how he answered. But I think it's safe to say that he answered as a negative. That, oh no, I mean, you know.
Oh no, I got me some family values. I'd never.
Never. I don't have anything shady in my background. Nothing sleazy. You know, I'm just pure as the driven snow. And so, you know.
And so, in the course of doing his due diligence, Roger reached out to other sources who confirmed that they did in fact in good faith believe that was Bill Pryor, correct?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And it wasn't just one or two people, was it?
No, it was. We had multiple sources.
I recall a quote from Roger's writing where one source said, "Oh my God, that's Bill Pryor."
Yeah, they did say that. And the resemblance is rather striking if you would, you know. I mean, I know he's young. I mean, people, his looks changed somewhat over a period of, you know, however many years, and we understand that. But, and, you know, he's face filled out a little bit and all that, and maybe his hair chopped. But, I mean, it's him. I mean, he has a eye condition, you know, that not that many people have. And that's obvious that person. As I mean, he's a dead ringer. I mean, you know.
So the Bill Pryor story ran up a huge red flag inside the Republican power structure of Alabama. Is that safe to say?
Yes, that would most definitely be safe to say. And that got him really, really stirred up. And it was after that, you know, just this whole Rob Riley thing. I mean, it's kind of strange because we've been, you know, like you've been writing about the Rob Riley Liberty Duke situation, you know, for a few months going back, you know, I don't know, earlier, I can't remember when they started, was it spring or summer or something. But then, you know, then all of a sudden something got concerned, I guess, mysteriously when the prior photo showed up.
Right. And okay, so to back up so everybody can keep up with, because you kind of need a program for this.
Yeah, you do.
Now, Rob, the man who beat, by virtue of the skullduggery in Baldwin County, beat Don Siegelman to become governor of Alabama was a man named Bob Riley. Have I got that right?
It was indeed Bob Riley.
And Bob Riley touted his Sunday school credentials and his upstanding Christian family values, which would presume... would include teaching one's children that once one has become bonded in holy matrimony, that one does not go out, as we would say here in the hills, a romping with somebody else's wife.
Exactly. Yeah,
and
exactly.
So Bob Riley has a son named Rob Riley, and what? Now he's being groomed for a run for Congress now, but what was he before that?
Gosh. Well, I mean, Rob, like I said, he's a private attorney here in Birmingham.
Yale educated, I believe.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And Roger, I guess, knows more details about him than, you know, I do, but I think that's probably, I don't know that he's ever really actually held public office, you know, but like I said, he's
But he was active within the Republican Party of Alabama.
He was very active in the Republican Party. And, you know, I think, you know, definitely, you know, you could, you know, it's not hard to imagine that he probably had aspirations to follow in his daddy's footsteps, you know. I mean, but like I said, he's a private attorney. And, but we've gotten, you know, pretty good authority, and there's, like, you know, out there that he's interested in this vacated seat of Spencer,
Spencer Baucus.
Spencer Baucus, okay, all right.
Another bastion of glorious conservatism.
I mean, they're good. I mean, it's, like, hard to, easy to get them mixed up. Both of them, I mean, it's, like, you can tell the difference.
Sure.
Yes, absolutely. It was circulated that he was interested in that, so I guess he got all fluttered that this stuff had been written, even though it was totally true, but he didn't want it out there because that might look, you know, might be bad.
And the journalism being done by your husband, Roger, was to the effect that, in fact, upstanding family values Republican Rob Riley had been, and perhaps ongoing, in an ongoing affair with a woman by the name of Liberty Duke, and we're not making that up.
Well, yes, she's not a stripper or a porn star. No, She's a lobbyist. I know it's hard to believe.
What kind of lobbyist?
Gosh, it's not like it was Dolphin Island or something. Like I said, Roger knows more about that. I can't remember exactly what kind of lobbyist, but, I mean, I can't really imagine that she's remotely qualified. I mean, she's, you know, actually not, but I mean, you kind of got that job with, you know, the Republican Party Riley's help. You know, she's just, because, I mean, her previous things were like, you know, she ran a daycare center, and, gosh, I can't remember what other kind of great credentials she had that would qualify for being a lobbyist.
So your husband writes about this salacious bit of Republican family values. And what did Rob Riley then do after your husband had published this story?
Well, we didn't really hear of anything for a while. Even, you know, Roger certainly contacted him and gave him a chance to comment and, you know, wanted to interview him and all this kind of stuff. And but, you know, after he'd written about it for a while, he did the same, of course, with Liberty, too. And he'd written about it for a while. I mean, we started hearing some rumblings that, you know, that he was going to sue us or something. It was just through grapevine. We didn't have anything official. But then starting in the last week of September, we started having these just sheriff's deputies showing up to a couple of times a day to, you know, like they were, like, trying to bust a meth lab or something. I
mean, at your home?
At our home, they were like coming, you know. I mean, it was just bizarre. I mean, it scared us to death. We had no idea it was anything civil. We had no idea it was, you know, they were, cause normally it was civil service. They'd just come and knock on the door, one guy, and they might come again, you know, the next week. I mean, it's not that, like I said, but they did this for a good week, you know, and we were like thinking, oh my God, they're going to try to get in here and see something or tear up stuff or trumped up arrest charges or gosh knows what. And so we were scared to answer the door the way they were acting so aggressive and everything. They would, like, you know, practically pull on the grass and the drug would, you know, like all the SWAT team or something. And so, but then finally, you know, some guy came by himself on a Sunday, I think that was 29th, I believe, of September, and knocked on the door and answered. And so then we had to proceed to go to the library, and when we pulled into the parking place of the library, all of a sudden there's a sheriff's deputy car right behind us, and we thought, uh-oh, you know, he was going to maybe try to get our computer. That's what, you know, I figured. Anyway, it was a trumped-up traffic stop. He just said that Roger had rolled through a stop sign, which he didn't, in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, yeah, it was the left-hand turn. We've lived here 20-something years. You know, we're good drivers, but we certainly, you know, I mean, we're like, other people may roll through right-hand turns, but we don't, and certainly not through a left-hand turn. And he claimed he was located at a specific spot in the neighborhood, and he could see it. And, well, we went back later and went where he said he was, and you cannot see the stop. You can't see that vantage point. You can't see it. You can't see, if somebody came to full stop or not. So, I mean, he's lying. Okay, I mean, but besides that, I mean, he came back and said he was going to issue Roger a warning, and so he did. He was back here 7 minutes when he said, you know, claims you've been served. Well, you can't, you know, you can't do that. You can't serve somebody, you know, like for a bogus traffic stop like that. I mean, he had to, what he had to do is, like, even if it was bogus, he had to, like, give it my stuff and then let us go on our way. You know, but he was detaining us, so I forget.
So he claimed to have served civil process papers on you during a traffic stop?
Yes, yes, right. If you can believe that. Yes. And you can't do that.
I mean, so that the papers themselves, then, if I understand correctly, scheduled some sort of a hearing before a circuit judge?
Yeah, we didn't really, you know, get word of that. Like, so we threw him out the window, you know, because we, like, it was just so mad, you know, got angry and drove off and everything. And, well, he almost arrested Roger. I mean, you know, he tried to do that. But anyway, you know, I was, you know, acting upset enough. I think he thought, the guy thought better of it and everything and decided to let him go. But, you know, he was claiming Roger was disturbing the peace or some such nonsense. So,
but I mean, that wasn't the end of it.
Right.
Yeah, that wasn't the end of it.
Mm-hmm. So, like, we threw the papers out, but essentially, from what we understand, like, there was some kind of a hearing the following day. Now, what lawsuit? I'm supposing this was, like, you know, it would have been bad enough if he had, like, stopped us on this traffic stop, which you can't do, and served us with just the suit itself. But it, well, in addition to the suit itself, was, you know, temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction and whatnot. All this stuff that we had no idea about. We were not involved in it. We didn't have a chance to say or have our say. I mean, you can't do that with defamation and by law. And so, you know, but you're supposed to be able to get, you know, to service. I mean, like I said, it would have been wrong if he'd just given us the suit itself and us having 30 days to respond. Because that's pretty much standard, I think, to have 30 days to respond. And that would have been bad enough. I mean, but to have a hearing the following day, I mean, sure.
So, this is, because when I first began reading about this, I thought there was some sort of divorce proceedings. And, you know, divorce proceedings are often under seal because we don't want that stuff being aired from, you know, from one corner of the state to the other. There's a public policy involved with that that makes a little bit of sense. But no, this is just a straight up lawsuit against Roger.
Yeah. Right. You know, defamation, and we know, you know, the old song, you can get anybody to sue anybody for anything. I mean, it doesn't mean they'll prevail, but I mean, that's the way it's set up, and everybody should have their due process and day in court, and you have proper service, make sure that that's done, and then the respondent, which would be us, or you know, and we would have the 30 days in order to either hire an attorney or represent ourselves or whatever we do to make a response, you know, basically to say we deny this or we object and we're asking for it to be dismissed or, you know, the standard stuff. And a lot of times it's not granted and it goes through a little process, but I mean, you have that opportunity to respond to these allegations. And, of course, it's up to the person bringing the claim to prove it, to prove the case. I mean, not us. But, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, oh, and also we happened to notice on the paper, it was stamped with a few papers from hanging in our car, but it was stamped in July. Now, okay. It is stamped, you know, that it was, I guess, filed in July sometime. And then, it was under seal since that time. It was the thing that was under seal. And so, what was going on all that, during the, from then until the end of September, and then all of a sudden they got all a flutter to have to try to serve us immediately. What were they doing? I mean, you know, if it was so important, why didn't he serve us in July? You know? I'm thinking it's probably what it has to do with the prior photos, conceivably. I mean, that's one theory, but I don't, or either that, or, yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, what would make him sit on it, and what would make him have it under seal? What would make him sit on it all that time? Who knows?
Well, it certainly sounds like no small amount of legal strategizing on the part of Mr. Riley. And what's more, it's not even a regular sitting circuit judge who's hearing the case. Is that correct?
That is correct. He was appointed by the Alabama Supreme Court. He's retired. I don't know what rock they got this guy from under.
What's his name?
I don't know why. A Claude Nielsen. Like no E on the end, C-L-A-U-D, I believe. And then I think maybe it's middle initial, maybe D, and it's N-E-I-L-S-O-N, I believe.
Okay.
I've never heard of him. I don't like this. He got appointed by the Alabama Supreme Court, and that's like, okay, that's weird. I mean,
is there any?
Everything you look at, it's weird. Everything's weird.
Is there anything, Carol, to indicate why a special judge was brought in instead of the regular judge?
That's a good question. One possibility is maybe just a. Riley, person that's going to rubber stamp whatever Riley wants. Although I would think that the Shelby County judges would too. I don't know what the issue is for that. I mean, I'm sure they would go along with pretty much whatever Riley's wanted and be so Republican and everything. So I don't know why they dug him up. Kind of hard to reach and whatnot. I mean, I don't even have, we don't really know where he's located, contact phone number for his office, anything. So it's kind of...
And even another journalist couldn't go and look at the court file right now. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's still under seal. Or even an attorney, because we've got, one attorney that makes it nothing definite, but we're, looking at trying to get some attorney, legal help. And one is did talk with Roger for a while on Monday afternoon and proceeded to try to see about getting the court, see the court, and it was under seal. So even an attorney that we might try to hire can't access it. He had to get this Rob Riley's law firm who is representing him. It's Rob Riley's law firm that's representing him.
And Rob Riley's law firm has apparently done all the drafting on the court orders. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Although, we thought that was outrageous, and it is outrageous and shouldn't be done, but evidently we have since learned, believe it or not, that that's commonplace, not just here, but even out in California and other places. So, it's hard to believe how hard to wrap your head around that he would draft, say, a contempt order or something like that, and, we'd fill in the blank in a couple places, and then he sent it to us, and it was like, can you believe this, Rob Riley's, writing the orders for the judge? And then, sure enough, a few days later, the judge just fills it and signs off on it. I mean, that's weird and should not be done, but evidently that may be one thing that maybe technically was maybe not improper. I mean, evidently it happened. But it was based on all this other stuff that was improper. I mean, should have even, how can you be held against contempt for, say, an injunction or a restraining order or something when that can't even be done by law in a defamation case? So,
just to continue the narrative of what has happened to your husband and you, the traffic stop was not the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what happened in the last week.
Well, the last week, let's see. I guess it's a week ago tonight. I guess today is Wednesday, isn't it? Roger. Well, actually, the week before that, Wednesday, the prior Wednesday, we had gone to file a motion to quash service, because we had the Thursday, whatever that Thursday was, Thursday before the 23rd, there was going to be a hearing. And so we did file a motion to quash service. They should have put sort of a stay on the proceedings, and we weren't, didn't have to show up, and that they should have, had a hearing on that motion to quash service. And they didn't, but they should have, because we got it in there, timely and all that. But they claimed they had the hearing, I guess, on Thursday. But so anyway, we had not heard anything about it being denied, which you can't outright deny it. You're supposed to have a hearing for the motion to quash. But Roger had gone to the library, work on the blog, and get a little bite to eat, and I was at home, and I was napping, and so from what I understand, Roger says that he had pulled into our driveway and pulled to go into the garage and was raising it up with the clicker, and it started. started to go up, and all of a sudden, out of this blue, the sheriff's car came flying at high speed down our driveway and almost hit our car or house or both. And it maybe stopped about, like, maybe a foot from the car. In fact, they hit it. And the guy said something goofy like, "How's your day going?" or "How are you?" or something goofy. And Roger says, "Well, you almost hit my car." You know, it's kind of like, he said, "What are you doing?" Or what, you know. And by this time, the door's up. The garage door had raised, and he proceeded to just pull on in the garage. And next thing you know, this sheriff is just, the deputy is just like there inside our garage, inside our house. And so Roger gets out of the car, and the guy says to him out, "Well, why don't you step outside?" And Roger says, "Why don't you step outside? You know, this is my house, and I'm going inside. You know, you don't have any business being here." And so he proceeded to walk away from him toward, you know, to go around the other part of the garage to go up the stairs. Well, at that juncture, you know, the guy had a legitimate, well, he shouldn't have just come into our house, but, you know, he could have said something.
No search warrant, right?
That's what I'm saying, no search warrant. And he could have said, actually, matter of fact, Mr. Schuler, I do have a business to be here because you're under arrest, and he's your in regiment's rights or something.
He present him with an arrest warrant?
No. He didn't present him with a search warrant, an arrest warrant. He didn't say you're under arrest. He didn't say there are charges against you. He didn't read him his, none of that. Said nothing. Said nothing of those about you that showed, had no paper to show him anything. So Roger's walking away, and he gets several, a few feet away, and all of a sudden this guy grabs him and throws him up against some storage boxes that we had down there, and he went flying. The boxes went everywhere.
And let's just to fill in a quick blank. How old is your husband?
My husband is 56, I believe. Yeah, 56.
And he was providing no. He wasn't providing any resistance. He wasn't running.
He was just trying to walk. You know, wasn't he? Because he, you know, he didn't close the garage door. Because I asked him, "Did you think about closing the garage?" Although, you know, it probably would have been a good idea. If he'd reached in the car for the clicker, or I guess he could have lowered it with a button. You have the button on the side of the wall. But he didn't close it. He left it open. And I guess it'd give the guy an opportunity to leave, because he said, you know, leave. And, of course, the guy wasn't having any of that. He was there to, you know, beat Roger up. Anyway, once he pushed him into these boxes, and Roger the boxes went everywhere, he maced him in the face. Okay, he maced him. And then there was some, Roger was trying to get him off of him, you know, and he was like, you know, just like, get off of me and everything. And then he, like, got shoved into our dog's, our late dog's pen we had down there, like a fencing material, real heavy, pushed it back a couple of feet, and it was, you know, major scuffle. Then three other sheriff's deputies appeared. I talked with Roger today. He said they must have been lying in wait. It was like four vehicles total. And they must have been nearby waiting for him to pull in or us leave. Maybe they weren't, I don't know if they were sure if they were we were here or not, but their plan was to confront him, and which they did. And then Roger said while he was being pummeled, they heard at least a couple of deputies up at our front door, pounding on the front door, saying something about that wife or that woman or the wife.
Namely you.
Yes, that meant me. They wanted to arrest me, too. And I was asleep in a sleeper or whatever, I guess, and I'm upstairs, and I didn't hear any of this stuff. I said between 6 and 6:30, I think, in the afternoon. And so When I didn't answer the door or anything, arrived, then they proceeded to stick him, you know, in the sheriff's car and turned out the light and lowered the garage door and took him off. They threatened to break his arm. Breaking his arms. And that, it was, like I said, still, you know, no reading of rights, no arrest, saying you're under arrest for these charges. Nothing. And so they take him down to Columbiana, which is about, I don't know, probably maybe 25 miles south of here or something. And so at 11:30, that's when I just got, I happened to wait. I didn't mean to sleep that late, but anyway, I was just, you know, really exhausted. We under a lot of stress and had some tiring days recently, and so I hadn't been sleeping good. So that's when I happened to wake up, and I thought, you know, what time is it? You know, I just didn't think, and it was like, oh my gosh, where's Roger, you know? And when I realized how late it was, I thought, what? Where's Roger? He must be asleep on the sofa. I thought he must have just like dozed off and was taking a nap on the sofa. And he wasn't. He wasn't anywhere in the house.
How long was it before you found out where he was?
Well, it was a little while, and in the meantime, I had a, you know, coronary, because, it startled me because I realized how late it was. I thought, you know, I didn't see him yet. Wasn't in the bed. Wasn't missing the bed. I didn't see him in our little den or office where we had a sofa taking a nap. And I saw, and I looked where he keeps his billfold. I didn't see his billfold. Because, you know, usually if he comes home and he's going to take an old nap, he'll, like, take stuff out of his pocket. You know how guys will take the billfold out.
Oh, sure.
Whatever. And so I didn't see his billfold. And my heart stopped. I thought, oh, my God, it's 11:30, and I don't see his billfold. He's been in a car accident. You know, that was my first thought, you know. And I come flying downstairs to the living room or whatever area, and I didn't see him anywhere. I was like, Roger, Roger. You know, I didn't see him. I thought, well, maybe he crashed. I thought, well, okay, calm down. You know, maybe he crashed and the billfold's just laying on the coffee table or something. No, he wasn't anywhere to be seen. So I thought, oh, Lord. So I went running down to the garage thinking, and just there was the car. So there was no car accident. His car was there. I thought, well, okay, that's weird. His car
were the were the signs of the physical altercation, did they become apparent to you when you looked around
the
garage?
Immediately. Yes, I mean, at first I saw the car, and I thought, well, okay, he's not a bloody, mangled mess on the side of the road. He's not been in a car accident, but he's not anywhere in the house. Where is he, you know? I mean, strange. And I glanced over, and I was like, what? I did the double take at this mess over where we had, like, store stuff, you know, the more storage area instead of where the cars are. It's like, oh, my God. You know, there was, like, stuff everywhere. I mean, just strewn. I mean, all out of order. I mean, you know, our garage normally does not look like that. I mean, obviously. And it was like, oh, my heart stopped again. It was like, and I went and I was looking around and I saw the pin had been pushed back. And I saw that the passenger side of the front seat, I mean, the window was rolled halfway down. His cut where he'd eaten. You know, was still in the, you know, floorboard, and receipt from where he'd eaten at was over there. I mean, it was like, okay, this is weird. This is, he's nowhere to be found. His car's here. But there's all this evidence of a scene. Somebody, and I thought, somebody, because we've gotten death threats and things over the years. And I thought, some criminal, some maniac or some goon or somebody that somebody's hired or something has come along and grabbed him, and they had a tussle and hauled him off and murdered him. That's what I thought.
What a horror to even contemplate.
I know. I mean, I've never been so horrified, scared in my life and everything. And I was like, you know, and I think I may have grabbed my cell phone when I realized he wasn't around, and I had it in my hand. Maybe I was like, I had called Roger. I called the phone that Roger had, and as it turned out, it was in the trunk along with his. So I found out later. I thought, oh my God, you know. And then later, I went down and checked to see once I realized he'd been arrested. But it was horrible to contemplate. I was like trying to call somebody or take somebody. It's like, oh my God, something's happened to Roger.
Well, how did you? I don't think we can even say he was arrested, can we? I mean, there was no
arrest. He wasn't.
He was abducted.
He was abducted. He was beaten severely and abducted, and he's in jail, but I don't consider it, you know, that he was arrested. But what happened was, is I came back upstairs, I was just shaking like a leaf, and I proceeded to think of who to call, and I ended up calling a friend of ours, a retired judge over in Mississippi, that is, you know, a real good friend and has his share of woes with, you know, being politically persecuted and whatnot, and I called him up. It was about midnight by this time, and they were about ready to get in bed. And I was like, I called him. I said, oh, my God, Roger, I think he's been abducted. He's been, you know, somebody's gotten him, nabbed him, and hauled him off. And the person said, could he have been arrested? And I was like, arrested? Because I didn't even think that, because, I mean, it was such a scene. You don't think when somebody's arrested, you know, that there would be that kind of scene. You think, you know, because Roger's not, you know, a violent person or whatever, and that it would be that kind of thing. So anyway, I was like, oh, my God. I said, well, I can't check because we didn't, right at the moment, don't have Wi-Fi at the house. We did, but we don't right now, and hadn't for a few weeks. But I said, gosh, I don't know how to check. And he said, well, hold on a minute. Let me look. I'll look online. So he was able to quickly call up the website. He said, well, here he is, inmate so-and-so. And I just thought, I cannot believe it. He arrested him, you know. And so that's when I found out, because he was able to look up and tell me. And it says $500 bond for resisting arrest. Resisting arrest? I thought, oh, God. And so anyway, I called and, you know, tried to talk with the sheriff in charge of the whatever. And I wasn't able to talk with Roger then. He said, well, he's not going to be able to, you know, talk. He's not able to come to phone or something. And
so he didn't even get his one phone call.
No. I think eventually he did sometime well after. It was probably maybe 1 in the morning, or maybe he was able to call me for a few minutes or something. But, no, I was like, I told the guy, I said, I thought he was supposed to have one phone call. Well, then what they were probably doing, I don't know if they were, like, waiting, if they had some ulterior or more motive to wait until after midnight. I mean, because let's think about it. He was arrested. He was assaulted and beaten and hauled off like between 6 and 6:30, and he didn't actually get taken to the holding area or the judge cell or whatever they call it and everything. He was in some kind of other holding area until after midnight. Now, what was the reason for that? Was it something to do with like the day that, you know, like as far as a number of days they can keep him or something? Of course, they can do whatever they want to. Gosh only knows how many days they might try to keep him. Hopefully, we'll get legal representation and be able to get him out. But I mean, we just wanted that. Curious. I mean, what was the purpose of that? What's the purpose of anything that they would do that? I mean, that they would hold him in some kind of area where he's not reachable.
Have you even seen him since?
No, I have not seen him since because. I've basically been on self-imposed house arrest. I haven't left the house, and I've just been staying.
Are you in fear? Are you in fear, Carol?
Yes, I am. I am in fear that they will arrest me because and possibly beat me up too, for gosh knows what. I mean, but the following day, on the Thursday, the 24th. A sheriff deputy, I don't know if it was more than one, maybe it might have been a couple, I don't know, but I was pounding at the door 3 different times through the day, including one after dark, after 7 o'clock at night. Scared me to death and everything, because I kept thinking, oh, God, they're going to knock the door down or something. But they didn't, but, I mean, it just scared me, and they left. And so I thought, you know, but I knew, I mean, something just told me, even before I talked with Roger, but, you know, Roger and I talked briefly, and it's like, yeah, you need to stay put, you know, for the time being, you know, so we see what's going on. And so I did, because I just thought, well, you know, they're gonna, I mean, and then, like, I think the next day, after I was able to get some money loaded up on his jail phone card, figured out how to do that, because we weren't able to call me after that, because they needed like money on the account. But he explained, got just telling me the story of how outrageous it was, the beating. I mean, I could tell it was outrageous by the physical evidence, but he was able to go into details about exactly how it went down. And then, you know, then he was like the next day after that, like on Friday, I talked with him, and that's when I was, you know, he said, he told me about that he didn't like say, I've got a search warrant, I've got an arrest warrant, you're under arrest. And that's it. I said, oh, my God, you're kidding me. I knew that he'd been beaten, but I thought, maybe they at least said, you know, you're under arrest, and then proceeded to, you know, rough him up real good. Obviously that's wrong, but I mean, I thought maybe at least they said something. But I said, oh my God, it's even worse. I mean, it's even more bizarre than we even imagined.
So you haven't been able, to see him, Carol. Has anyone been able to see him?
Let's see. We did have a lawyer go and see him on, a couple of days ago, Monday afternoon, and
there was,
you know, that, yeah.
Okay, so someone has seen him, but if I understand correctly, you say that he was charged with what, obstructing or resisting arrest or something?
Yeah, they're claiming resisting arrest. Although how you can resist arrest when they never say anything about you're under arrest?
Sure, but I just want to work I want to work through this real carefully.
Exactly.
He was charged as far as you know with a crime. Resisting arrest or obstruction of an officer arrest. Or whatever it's called down there.
Yeah, it's called resisting arrest. And the bond was originally set at $500, but mysteriously the next day suddenly it doubled. It became $1,000. So that was weird. I mean, everything about this is weird, but yeah, so that was what we were told.
And you've referenced your house, your garage.
Mm-hmm.
You are property owners in the state of Alabama?
Yes,
Okay. I'm just trying to sort out, but the charge, the underlying charge that sent the deputies to your home was allegedly a contempt citation?
Yeah, it was supposedly two contempt citations. I guess one for the Liberty Duke, person, it was two separate suits. One from Duke against myself and Roger, and then one from Riley against myself and Roger. And they're calling me. I got promoted. I didn't realize that. You're calling me administrator of the blog. I didn't realize I was administrator of the blog. I'm not administrator of the blog.
Let's be clear about that. You're not. Did you say you are not administrator of the blog?
No, I'm not administrator of the blog. I'm Roger's wife, and Roger's legal snouser, and he blogs. He's the writer and researcher. I mean, you know. I mean, I might help, you know, I like my videotape him if on videotape, or we have taken a couple of road trips to get the all-famous Bill Pryor picture I went with him to go get. But, I mean, as far as, I don't administrate it. I mean, I might say, could you, proofread it? I might read it and say, oh, here's a typo you need to fix. I mean,
right.
Is that considered administrative? That's just considered an espousal.
Well, at this point in time, I have no idea, Carol, because apparently the Constitution of the United States is not in force in Shelby County, Alabama.
No, it is not.
Let me.
The entire state of Alabama.
Well, that could well be. Let me explore this just a little bit further with you, if I may. Just a couple of things that you've mentioned along the way. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we've got all of this completely in order. Mm-hmm. Your husband was assaulted, battered, abducted from his own home by people who were purporting to be agents of the sheriff's office of Shelby County, Alabama, correct?
Correct.
You have not seen him since that abduction?
Mm-mm.
You have spoken to him only by phone?
By phone.
He has not been afforded...
No medical.
He has not received any medical treatment, to the best of your knowledge, or examination.
He has not.
For the injuries he sustained in the course of the assault, the battery, and the abduction.
Mm-hmm. He told me he had, wounds all over him. He had, cuts, bruises, and abrasions all over him. And it really hurt me, it was really hurt bad. And I asked him recently, I said, well, how are you doing? I said, how are your wounds faring, with no treatment? He said, well, they aren't, healing, but these are my knees still hurt really bad. But just, But
does he have any health issues that the Shelby County authorities should take into account?
Well, I mean,
high blood pressure, diabetes, heart condition.
No, thankfully, he's healthy in that regard, and we've been under, with this since this legal thing started, we both, or take stuff for, have to, for depression and anxiety and everything, medication to just cope with this. I mean, we didn't before.
Do you have any indication one way or the other, Carol, as to whether, his prescription medications are being administered?
Oh, no. Because, generally, from what I understand, like I said, this is our first experience with any kind of criminal anything. I mean, we're not, we don't have a criminal record, don't have any experience. But that's something that usually a family member or something will take, you know, their prescriptions and give it to the, and the jailers or whatever will...
Wow, just like 13th century England or,
uh-huh.
or 10th century Paris.
Exactly. But, I mean, the thing is, I can't go down there because, I mean, they'll arrest me, likely, you know. And also, do we really want any of the jailers giving him pills? I mean, think about it. Think about that for a second. So right now, even if I had, like, say, a family friend who's willing, like, I'll go down there and take his pill. You know, you don't have to go down there.
Right, right.
Do we really want? I mean, you know.
No, I think you raise a very valid point. Let me ask you a question about your current circumstances, Carol. It is my understanding that as a result of a lot of this journalism that your husband has been doing, that you are in rather, and with everything that's happened in the last month and in particular in the last week, you are in desperate financial circumstances. Is that correct?
Yes, we are. You know, absolutely. Like, so we, you know, he was cheated out of a job in 08. I've been cheated in 09. I don't know. It's just gone from bad to worse and everything, and tried to make it on savings and various things like that, and got a little bit of help, but not too much. But we've finally broke down, and you know, we just hated to, you know, just be, you know, having our hand out and everything. But we decided, gosh, you know, before this, you know, he was arrested. Oh, I say arrested, before he was assaulted and abducted. About a week or 2 weeks before, we decided, you know, we needed to put the PayPal button on the blog. You know, just to see if we could, you know, maybe get some sort of little bit of help with basic living expenses and whatnot. So,
and Matt Osborne has initiated a legal defense fund. Is that correct?
Oh, okay. You know, I think yeah. That's good to hear, because I think we're going to need it. Because, you know, all this mess has wiped us out good. You know, all, you know, this, you know, years of... But one thing about being pro se, I mean, you know, we were able to, like, save money on lawyer fees. Of course, there's still, like, filing fees and other administrative-type fees related to dealing with your own suits and everything. But you do save a little bit, but still, that doesn't make up for the fact when you lose a job. You know, when he got, you know, ousted from UAB over the blog, even though he, you know, didn't blog on the job or anything, but that's the reason he got fired. They told him point blank that it was because of what he was blogging on Siegelman,
mm-hmm.
Even though it was on his own time. So, and then I was the only breadwinner. You know, I wasn't making that much money and everything, so it was really stressful on me. But in 09, I got cheated out of my job. So, since, you know, this has been kind of rough, you know, really rough, you know, trying to make it, and that way we hadn't, like, our home, I'm kind of worried about it and everything. So it's been over a year since we've paid our mortgage. And,
oh, God.
Everything. Yeah, I know. So I was like, oh, my God, you know. But right now, I mean, obviously, forefront, more than important than anything else, is Roger's welfare, his health and safety, and to get out of there. I mean, you know, that's, you know, you know, we'll deal with that when we, you know, like I said, we'll deal with that. I mean,
I understand, but let me ask you then, what is next? I mean, is there a hearing scheduled? Is anybody strategizing how to get Roger out of jail?
Well, we, like I said, we did, we've got a few lawyers we've talked with, but one in particular, had been contacted by several supporters and, you know, certain people and whatnot, that he's a constitutional lawyer here in the state, does pretty much federal work in all, I think, but he visited with him, and like I said, he proceeded to try to get the, like I said, because it was under seal. I mean, he couldn't, like, just like, oh, well, let me check or whatever, and he proceeded to have to call the Riley firm to get the file sent. We were hoping that he got that in the mail today, and maybe we'll have some better idea. But he is just absolutely blown away by all the unlawful and unconstitutional and just outrageous, bizarre, I mean, you just pick a word, things that have gone on from start to finish with this whole deal.
I'll ask you one question. Have you reached out to the American Civil Liberties Union?
I need to do that. I've got on my list of people to contact and places to contact. But yeah, that might be worth it. I think I did actually call. I did call them one number, and it was an automated thing. So I mean, you send a letter and all this, and I was like, oh God, we don't even have. Well, he said, not only do we have Wi-Fi, but here lately we haven't even. We ran out of black ink for a printer and a printer paper, and we haven't been able to afford that. Roger was in the library about a week or so too before he got arrested, and literally didn't have barely had enough money to get Kit Kat out of the machine. I mean, that's
oh
not,
God! And let's make one thing clear for folks: the illegal order that the judge imposed upon Roger demanded not only that he stop writing about Rob Riley's alleged affair with Liberty. What was her name again?
Duke.
With Liberty Duke. The judge also commanded, again illegally, as far as I'm concerned. That all posts be removed?
Right, all posts, yes.
Are those,
not just from henceforth, but also to go back and remove the previous posts. I mean, they were there. Because he wanted it purged, because like I said, I mean, that's just not going to look good for this conservative,
upstanding, God-fearing, family values Republican.
To have any kind of thing like that. Although it's been picked up other places, so even if it does get removed from Roger's blog, it's out there, you know.
And I know this story actually finally hit one of the larger progressive blogs out there, Think Progress, at 106 this afternoon, 12:06 your time. So hopefully a lot more people will know your story, Carol.
And we've been real encouraged by that. It's been picked up by a lot of different venues, and some of them, unfortunately, some of them are even, necessarily I'm not happy with the way they've portrayed Roger, but even the more conservative type, outfits, say this is unconstitutional. I mean, you can't do that. Even if you disagree, even if they claim to disagree with maybe our politics or this and that, what was done was not remotely lawful. So, but it's been plagued up by, conservatives. I think Birmingham News picked up on it. I don't know that it was the most flattering thing. I haven't read it because, like I said, I don't have Wi-Fi. But, I don't know. There's just a variety. And Al Jazeera, I believe, they picked up on it and did a story and judicial, let's see, justice. What is it called? Justice Integrity Project.
Yes, I just saw a link to that from one of our listeners who is hearing your account.
Right, Peter B. Collins, of course,
Right, Peter B. Collins.
Just a number of places, and we're continuing. It's like more and more places are interested. It's just kind of we're hoping this goes really viral.
Well, you have this story just gives us a pretty good idea that a lot in Alabama, for all the talk about how the Deep South has changed, a lot in Alabama has not. At this point in time, it certainly feels like Alabama is the place where justice goes to die.
It does. It does. And it really, it's almost harder. Oh, I'm not going to say it's harder. I mean, obviously. But, as far as, the civil rights movement and all that, as far as African-American, how they are treated and whatnot. But, to be, white liberal, they hate, it's like the Republicans hate us almost more. They hated Siegelman more because, it's like, you're supposed to be one of us. You're supposed to be conservative. What's wrong with you? Kind of thing. I mean, it's like they come down harder almost in this latest wave of thuggery. it seems to me. I mean, cause like I said, they've really come down hard on it's like somebody referenced, I forget, it's like a crime to be a liberal in the state, particularly probably if you're white. I mean, it's all they expect, it's just unnerving and upsetting. And,
well, I'm concerned. I'm very much concerned for your own well-being, and I hope you stay strong. You have to stay strong, Carol, because this is not that I'm giving orders or anything, but
no,
you know, this is you now find yourself, and I'm sure you already realize it, on the absolute front lines of the struggle for freedom in this country. You know, when you get a chance to tell Roger, talk to Roger, tell him that he has the support and the best hopes of a whole lot of people behind him. And I hope that the next time we talk, and I hope we will talk again, Carol, I hope that the next time we talk, we can talk about how the Shelby County Circuit Court, Rob Riley, his daddy, and Liberty Duke, and everybody, the Garrison woman, I forgot to mention Carl Rove is his tentacles run into this at least tangentially.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But that they have all been dragged kicking and screaming to something resembling justice. Carol, I wish you well, and I'll remind folks now that a legal defense fund has been set up for Roger Shuler over at osborneinc.com,
mm-hmm.
and that will go to help in the effort to obtain justice for Roger.
We're hoping for somebody pro bono. I think there's, you know, definitely should be, you know, well, like I said, the guy that talked with him Monday, I think might be willing to do it pro bono, at least the initial part. So I'm hoping, you know, that maybe we won't incur as many expenses, but I mean, gosh knows, you know, that's, you never know when you get involved with that kind of stuff. So yeah, it definitely helps that, you know, you have to have a legal defense fund, and also the PayPal button on the blog for any sort of other.
Right. And anybody searching for Legal Schnauzer can find that there.
Yeah, legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. But yeah, we appreciate everyone's support and any help that anybody can lend, and appreciate you having me on. And
well, it's an honor. Anybody standing up for justice and standing up for integrity and standing up for the rights of free speech and a free, real media within this country has my admiration. Carol, I wish you well.
Oh, thank you.
And again,
our
fondest and best regards to Roger, please.
I will tell him, and thank you so much, Bob, for having me on.
It's been an honor. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye now. Carol Shuler, wife of Roger Shuler, who is at this moment imprisoned in Alabamistan on having been assaulted, battered, abducted, and dragged off to incarceration on nothing more than the whim of a circuit judge with no more sense of the proprieties and actual legal precedents surrounding the First Amendment guarantees of freedom of the press in this country than a hog knows about Sunday haberdashery. This is a not disturbing item. This is a terrifying item. In many ways, you can see this account as the nightmare portrait of where the right wing and the Republican Party seek to take this country. You've heard Dr. Bill talk in the last week about how there really is, and I've talked about it too, how there really is a plan in this country to do away with the forms of government which we perhaps have taken for granted. Alabamistan and its little petty dictators, its abusers of the law, its pettifoggers, are a laboratory for all of that. Again, Roger Shuler's Legal Defense Fund is soliciting contributions over at osborneinc.com. You can also find a link to that at Matt's Twitter feed, Osborne Inc. on Twitter. The hashtag is op O-P, Shuler, S-H-U-L-E-R. You know, I've got one question. And I have no connections whatsoever, no way of knowing. I don't know if anybody within the reach of my voice has any way of knowing. But when you start talking about an entirely corrupt member of the federal bench who touts his anti-gay family values, his anti-gay Christian family values, and yet posed full-on naked with what apparently passes for him for an erection, and apparently lied about it in the course of being vetted to be a federal judge, I only have one question. Where is Anonymous when you need him? Just ask. Not saying that they're not there, but just, where's Anonymous? Where's Anonymous when maybe it would be handy to know a little more about the alleged extramarital romping between upstanding, God-fearing, Christian, family values, anti-gay Republican Rob Riley and Liberty Duke? There's one more thing here. And I did not wish to mention this in the context of my conversation with Carol Shuler, but I just happened to wander over to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. And the very first post that appears there, the very top post, legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, of course, Schnauzer, S-C-H-N-A-U-Z-E-R, legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. The very top post you will see there is from Thursday, October the 24th, Liberty Duke paid a heavy price in quickie divorce that followed extramarital affair with Rob Riley. This, remember, is Alabama. It may be 2013 for a lot of us, but it might as well be 1853 in Alabama. There's an old story in Alabama politics about the late politician and demagogue Big Jim Folsom. Big Jim Folsom, and politics is a bloody contact sport in Alabama. You need to understand this. Big Jim Folsom had been accused of that most heinous of cultural and political sins for his era in the state of Alabama. He was accused of not only having an affair, but of having an affair with a woman of insufficiently lightly toned skin. Now, back in the day, and this may be apocryphal, but it's a story any kid growing up who pays attention to politics in Alabama will hear sooner or later. Some enterprising journalist, confronted Big Jim Folsom about his alleged affair with a woman with insufficiently light-toned skin, saying, "Is it true that you slept with that woman?" Big Jim Folsom replied, "It's a damn lie." And then he kind of smiled, that toothy political smile of the classic Southern politician, and he said, "Didn't neither one of us get a wink of sleep." Next question. Run over to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com and get a quick gander at Liberty Duke. Never mind the Christian family values. Get a gander at Liberty Duke, and you'll understand why Rob Riley is doing everything in his power to make this story go the hell away. Yeah. So thanks again to Carol Schuler, who, in the midst of an absolute crisis in her life, was willing to take an hour of her life and share it with us. Thank you, Mrs. Schuler. And thank you, Mr. Schuler, for doing what you have done to expose the seedy, low-rent cesspool that is Republican politics. Deep in what on that state's license tags proclaim to be the heart of Dixie. Going to take a break here. We're about halfway through the program. Your calls and your comments, your thoughts on this story are most welcome. 304-658-3333 is the number. If you wish to reach the program on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid Horn is the handle over there. If you have never been on the Skype line before and we're not hooked up as friends or contacts or whatever, then simply send me a contact request at Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. I'll approve it. And, well, heck, who knows how quickly you'll be on the air? Probably a matter of nanoseconds. All right? Really and for truly, this is conversation radio. And with Lou Reed having passed away recently, I ran across a lyric of his that seems terribly, terribly apropos under the circumstances. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
They say he didn't have an enemy. His was the greatness to behold. He was the last surviving progeny, the last one on the side of the world. Measured a half mile from tip to tail, silver and black, the powerful fins. They say he could split a mountain in two. That's how he got the Grand Canyon. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Some say they saw him at the Great Lakes. Some say they saw him off of Florida. My mother said she saw him in Chinatown. But you can't always trust your mother. Off the Carolinas, the sun shines brightly in the day. The lighthouse glows ghostly there at night. Chief of a local tribe that killed the racist mayor's son. Been on death row since 1958. The mayor's kid was a rowdy pig. Spit on Indians and lots worse. The old chief buried a hatchet in his head. Life compared to death for him seemed worse. The tribal brothers gathered in the lighthouse to sing. Tried to conjure up a storm or a rain. The harbor parted. The great whale sprang full up. It caused a huge tidal wave. The wave crushed the jail and freed the chief. The tribe let out a roar. The whites were drowned. The browns and reds set free. But sadly, one thing more. Some local yokel member of the NRA kept a bazooka in his living room. And thinking he had the chief in his sights, threw the whale's brains out with a lead harpoon. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Well, Americans don't care for much of anything. Land and water the least. And animal life is low on the totem pole. With human life not worth more than infected yeast. Americans don't care too much for beauty. They'll shit in a river, dump battery acid in a stream. They'll watch dead rats wash up on the beach. Complain if they can't swim. They say things are done for the majority. Don't believe half of what you see, none of what you hear. It's like what my painter friend Donald said to me. Stick a fork in their ass and turn them over, they're done.
Lou Reed, The Last Great American Whale. It is Prayer Meeting Wednesday, sort of put on hold here on the Horn this 30th day of October 2013. 7:35 p.m. here on in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. Email from Ron and Raleigh, hoo-wee, being the subject line. Hey, Bob, not being the sort of person to go all ad hominem on someone, but Ms. Duke could make a freight train take a dirt road. You know, that's the beautiful thing, except for living in a culture that still has deeply enshrined racism. There's somebody for everybody. You will find that Ms. Duke apparently bailed out of her marriage in a drop-dead hurry, just as quick as the feces struck the fan blades. Gave up her rights to the home. Waived all alimony, took on all credit card debt, saved and held her hubby harmless from any liability arising from indebtedness related to the said accounts. Yeah. What a nightmare. What a nightmare to be in. Let's go to the phone lines. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
What's happening, Jeremy?
That story is frightening, to say the least.
And it can happen. And it can happen to anybody who crosses power. And I think Jeremy, we need to be careful that we caution ourselves. That just because this is happening in Alabama doesn't mean it can only happen in Alabama or a Mississippi or a Georgia or a Tennessee or an Arkansas.
No, I believe full well it can happen here in the northern states too. It all depends on if you cross the wrong people with power, money, and they're corrupt. I mean, I think I mentioned a story a couple months ago how there's an officer around here who basically has been pulling people over and bullying them, including my girlfriend. He had followed her for, I think, 4 miles after he had initially seen her. Eventually pulled her over and said, "You know, I pulled you over." And she said, "No, why?" He goes, "You won't wear your seatbelt back there." She says, "Well, I've got it on now." He said, "Well, you won't wear it back there." And basically she said, "Prove I wasn't wearing it back there. Why didn't you pull it back there?" And he said, "Well, you didn't have it on back there, but you have something hanging from your mirror." So he came back and issued her a ticket for the seatbelt and something hanging from the mirror. Now, she fought this and got it reduced to something on the mirror. They dropped the seatbelt because he couldn't prove it. But just this summer, the same officer was brought to the court of appeals by someone he had pulled over saying they ran a red light when his cruiser video shows the guy never did any of the sort. So, I don't know. And then there's a story about the other trooper from Vermont who was padding his time card to the tune of $200,000 over the course of a few years of writing bonus tickets. He's the one I complained about a couple weeks ago who just got out after serving, I think, 7 months of a 2-year sentence for good behavior.
Wow.
So I...
Yeah. No, it is all over. But when you see when you see stuff like this, when you hear, what would any of us do in a situation like that? I mean, can you imagine, Jeremy, to be afraid to set foot out of your own home because you never know when some uniformed thug is going to show up and roll you too?
I can only imagine what it's like to have to live in that kind of, I guess, basically fear.
I mean, this is the kind of stuff that Ronald Reagan told us they only did in the Soviet Union.
I would say it's happened here. I mean, look at the look back to our Civil War. It happened then; it still happens today, obviously. But look at the whole idea of what was the mountain? Cold Mountain.
Yeah.
Whatever it was that had Heath Slater in it, where if you were considered a traitor, they came looking for you to the ends of the earth. If they even thought you were there, they'd find you and try to kill you. Things like this leave me speechless because you like to think they don't happen, but obviously they do. And where there's just one story, I'm sure there's hundreds, if not thousands, of them nationwide of corruption, bullying people to the extent they do.
Yeah, it goes on. And that makes it all the more important, I think, Jeremy, when we see these things, to shine some sort of a light on it.
Right. And I wanted to kind of switch the subject for a couple minutes anyway.
Sure.
I had mentioned Friday, sorry you didn't make it down to the funeral after the tire incident, that's unfortunate. But I mentioned how I was with the program of Spirit. I was actually in Salem for the weekend, at Salem, Massachusetts. Don't ever go there the weekend before Halloween. Big mistake.
Oh, that's like Christmas in North Pole, Arkansas or whatever.
We didn't really think about it at the time. We didn't really think much of it. We were there for the weekend before Halloween, and there had to have been, I bet there was 100,000 people in that small town. It's a very interesting town due to the rich history, much of it horrific, but it's greatly to it. But we took one of those fabulous walking tours where they tell you about the spooks and the haunts and what people believe have happened. And we got to this one house, and it turned my stomach. I didn't say anything because in a large crowd, you know, I'm not sure how to handle this, but I think I'll get my point across about it. Anyway, it was, I forget what it's called, but it has Ward in the name of the house. It's basically a house that was built on the foundation of the original High Sheriff of Salem. He was the one that saw through the execution of 27 innocent people, including the man he crushed with rocks. Well, this is supposed to be one of the haunted houses by him. And the tour guide, and of course a lot of this is probably exaggerated to some degree to make it a more fabulous, fun tour. He said that it's in George Washington's personal diaries and journals. He spent the night in this house one night and had to leave halfway through the night because he said he felt something not right about the house. That being said, he said, I want everyone to pull out your smartphones right now. And they did. He said, now Google this house. And a lot of people did. He goes, what do you see? And everyone saw this ghastly image, kind of a mix between, you couldn't tell what it really was. And he said, can you tell the sex? And everyone said no. He says, that's because that's the sheriff. He says, it's believed that he was a transvestite and hated women because of it. So therefore is why he saw the execution of all these people in Salem. Now, that kind of bristled me because that's mixing two genres and still turning that evil tide that people that don't fit the norm are bad people. And it disturbed me. It really did. That they're still, in small pockets, even though in the guise of entertainment, they're trying to take it as a bad thing and say that because of this, it made him a bad person and that's why he killed people.
Jesus. That's true.
Yeah, I shook my head at it. Now, thankfully after that, there was one happy story, kind of a funny story, which I'll share with you quickly. It turns out that Houdini, maybe Harry Houdini,
right,
spent a lot of time in film. I didn't know that. He wasn't even been from there, from what I heard. His name isn't really Harry Houdini, it's Frank something, so he was American. But anyway, I guess at one point, the police station, the old police station in Salem, had upgraded all their cells, all their locks, everything. New technology for the time, around 1904. And I guess the sheriff at the time had gotten the notice out that their cells were unpickable. No one could pick them, not even Harry Houdini himself. Well, Harry Houdini got word of this, and one night in 1904 in the summer, during one of his performances in a theater that no longer stands in Salem, looked at the audience and said, "Hey, come with me." He brought them to the police station. It was probably 7 o'clock at night. Knocked on the door, and the sheriff came out and said, "Well, how can I help you, Harry?" And he said, "You said that nobody can break out of the jail." He said, "I'll be the first." So the sheriff, thinking highly of himself, kind of chuckled, said, "Okay, we're up to it." They stripped him down, put a towel around him, patted him down, escorted him into one of the jail cells. And at the time, Salem was still a big port, so it was actually a drunk tank, too, for sailors that came in drunk. Anyway, they shackled him, shackled his feet, put him behind his back, locked him in the cell, walked out. The sheriff spoke, told the audience of probably like 100 people or so, "You might as well go home because in 10 minutes, we're going to have to go and let him out because he's not going to get out." 3 minutes and 18 seconds later, Houdini appeared at the door, shackled to his next-door neighbor from a different cell. And the story says that the sheriff backed down from his statement and kindly kind of disappeared from the public scene after that, not too long. So that was a funny story. But the first story I said really... It really angered me because people kind of laughed and snickered when he said what he said, but also that they would twist that in there and try to make it sound like they're bad people or anyone like that's a bad person. And it would drive them to do horrible things. And I'm sure in some cases it has, but that is really kind of just grouping everyone into one group of this is bad behavior.
To say the least.
Right. Now, I also do find it funny because as we were leaving, I believe it was Saturday night, we stopped at one of the last venues near what was called the Witch Dungeon. Basically, it was a reenactment of a witch trial. But this was a place across from the street from not the witch trial place. So we walked up to a guy, and he had a Swiss accent. We asked him what his show was about. And he said, "It's probably the best show you'll see here." He says, "We don't try to tell you about dungeons and witchcraft, because none of that really happened. Just tell you about the fears of people in those days." That put up my red flags right there when we walked away. I'm pretty sure it was a religious performance because he said that the witch dungeons didn't exist, the dungeons in Salem didn't exist, and the witch trials never happened.
But they did.
But, well, that was our point. We said they did. He goes, "Oh, no, that's all fairy tale. That never happened. There was never any dungeons here, and there's never any..." So, but I basically believe by what he was saying by the fears of the people of the time, they were Puritans, so it was a godly fear. A fear of an imminent, large, bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky that was going to strike them down at any moment.
Right, and if you've heard Dr. Bill talking about, especially his discussion of American exceptionalism, it's born out of that community. You know, they felt like they had a covenant with the Almighty. And consequently, that drove them, one of the bad sides of that was that drove them to ferocious acts of cruelty in order to somehow preserve that perceived covenant.
Yeah.
So it explains, I'm trying to remember the name of the man who was pressed to death. During that same
Giles
time.
Giles Corey, I think? Maybe.
Yes, Giles yes, Corey, yes. Because his last words were when they offered him an opportunity to recant or confess Christ or renounce the devil, or his only words, and they were his last words, were, "More weight."
Actually, his only words were, "More weight."
Ah, okay.
Giles Corey was 81 at the time. And one of the people who was accused, or well, witnesses claimed he was in cahoots with the devil, and basically every time they put weights on him, he would just say more weight. Those were his last words, though.
Yeah.
And the same sheriff that I spoke of earlier, who they tried to link to transvestites and being evil, you know, if there's an evil person, I'd say in my mind, you're fighting an evil person for what he did in life. Or at least, maybe we shouldn't say evil, but didn't act normally. He was probably mentally ill. And, well, he did that with the rocks. He was also jumping up and down on that door. So he had all the weight plus a full-sized man jumping in on top of him. He survived for 3 days.
There's the zeal of salvation, Jeremy.
Right. And I guess the deal was, if you admitted to it, they treat you, and basically you get the same treatment that you get today with the Amish. Basically, you would be stripped of all your earthly possessions and shunned.
And driven out of the community. I'm trying to think. Roger, the man who founded Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, can't remember his last name now, was subjected to exactly that.
Right. And basically, in those days, if you were driven to the community, you pretty much were left to die. You had no possessions. You were stripped down to everything but, like, maybe your underwear. And also in those days, another thing I didn't know about the Salem Witch Trials was that in those days, the Puritan culture, if you were, and this happened in the Amish community, you see it in Amish Mafia, but it really does happen in real life. If you're shunned by the community, they'll come and sell everything in your house in front of you and liquidate all your assets. And that would happen with the Puritans, too. But the interesting thing was that the sheriff got a 50% share of whatever they sold for any house they liquidated.
Well, sure, and some of those structures still exist legally today. For instance, in West Virginia, Jeremy, I don't know about Vermont, maybe there too. I'm not sure how many other states. But what is referred to around here is the high sheriff. The job of the high sheriff was not traditionally law enforcement. The high sheriff, the shire reeve, if you look back to Chaucer, I think, isn't there a reeve's tale there? The shire reeve, the sheriff, his job was to be the tax collector. And we still have that ancient structure here in West Virginia. The county assessor assesses all the taxation, and then the sheriff is in charge of collecting it. And the sheriff gets a commission on taxes collected to this day. So that if you're the sheriff of, say, West Virginia's most populous county, your salary can get real nice real quick if you're pretty zealous about collecting your taxes.
Yeah, and actually, Giles Corey, in the process of what happened to him, he actually put out a proclamation, which in all likelihood is just a coincidence. No one believes in probably really in curses, more coincidence than the thought curses of things that people might believe would happen. He had said that due to what this high sheriff had done, every sheriff in office would die before his service term was complete. And that happened right up till 94, maybe 2004. I got my dates mixed up. But the last high sheriff abolished that position and turned it into the police chief. He retired, and 4 years later, he died of a heart attack. Since then, nobody has died while in office.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Jeremy, you have yourself a good evening. I appreciate your thoughts on Mrs. Schuller. And hopefully we will talk soon.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. And onward we go. Lines opened, 304-658-3333. Or on Skype, Bob Kincaidhorn, BobKincaidHorn. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, Dave. How about you?
This is Jeremy. Oh man, that story was horrific. I can't believe that. I was checking it out on Al Jazeera, actually. Yeah, that's good that it's getting out there. I'm glad they're spreading it around. I mean, they gotta call Eric Holder about this stuff. This is just getting so out of hand in this country. The police are just you know, they think they can do anything. And these elites, I mean, they're just out of control. It's nuts.
Yeah, and that's, I think Dave, you do a real service in describing these folks as elites, because Rob Riley, you know, edumacated up to the Yale University College of Law, and done come back down to Alabama to, you know, use the law to his own advantage, with dreams and aspirations of someday standing up in the House of Representatives and talking about conservative Christian family values. And yeah, there's no getting around the fact that this guy is a one percenter in a big way. And the fact that he was able to leverage this many lackeys is absolutely shocking, or not, perhaps. I don't know. You know, maybe it's one of those Jack Nicholson forget about it, Jake, it's Chinatown moments.
Well, I got to say that you know, no fault of theirs, but if I lived down there, I would just I wouldn't be writing a blog about the local judge. That's the way they run the business down there. They should move to Bellingham, Washington, or something, or Maine, and do their blog from there. But
the thing is, if your goal is to expose the rich fields that are political corruption inside Alabama, it's kind of hard to do that from Maine. I mean, they're you know, we talk a lot about the miracle of the internet and how it changes how it changes everything. But the fact of the matter is, it doesn't. Journalism is still something that has to be practiced by people on the ground talking to other people. I can have a conversation with Mrs. Schuller, and she can lay out all the facts. But in point of fact, right now, I just got a note from Matt Osborne, who is down there right now, and he said, "I am no crime scene analyst, but Mr. Schuller must be one dangerous blogger to cause that much damage." They wrecked the place when they assaulted him, battered him, and abducted him.
Oh, that's awful. That's awful. But you know, I think I have to say this about journalism. I think that the internet has changed a lot about journalism, because it's given ordinary people and a lot more people a lot more voice. Because I mean, this story has gone like worldwide now. You know, people are reading about it in the Netherlands and in New Zealand and anywhere in between, because it's on Al Jazeera. So, I mean, you got to know that it's exposure to it, of it. Well, that's a good thing. I think that's a really a good thing. It's just amazing how you know, something like that can go, like they say, viral. You know, it just goes viral and it's around the world. And that's why they're cracking down so much, because you can get the word out about something that this is just an outrage. That's just completely outrageous. Totally, totally outrageous. You know, I'll tell you what, even here in Portland, Oregon, or anywhere, I when I talk to the cops, I keep my head down and I say yes sir, no sir. I kiss their ass, to the point where, you know, I would never talk challengingly to a cop, because they can get away with murder, and they do these days.
Witness Santa Rosa, California.
Yeah, exactly. Like we were talking last night. I mean, it's just like kids.
Seven rounds were pumped into that body.
Oh yeah, well, I told you they were ranting and raving about it on the radio, our local radio here, yesterday, and they just had all these people who went to the meeting who were family members of other kids that were, they were shot 10 times, they were shot 14 times, they were shot this, they were shot that. I mean, you know, the cops, they'll just let loose on you.
And yet, I actually thought of you earlier today, your having brought this story up last night. I had occasion to be in the automobile and heard a little bit of National Petroleum Radio doing a story about this incident in Santa Rosa. And they brought on some preacher who was a community leader. You can almost hear the air quotes around him, right? And he said, Well, if we're going to heal, we're going to have to acknowledge that this is partly our fault, too. How about ran off the road?
What? That's bizarre. That's totally bizarre. But I think we need to just move beyond that and taking action to correct the situation and not waste any more time laying blame. It's just totally wrong, the lack of justice, and people can't, you know, I mean, people can't walk the streets and feel safe and secure. The police are just going over the top. North of Portland, we've got a town called Vancouver, Washington. You ever heard of Vancouver, Washington?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just on the north bank of the Columbia River there. And I was talking to Malloy one day, telling him about it, because he had a caller or somebody that was from Vancouver. And I said, yeah, the thing about Vancouver is they call it Vantucky. It's Vantucky. It's really a redneck, scary suburb of the city of Portland. And a guy that I know had gotten into it with the cops there, and he had actually gotten the badge number of this cop and said he was going to make a complaint, and he did make a complaint, and the cops were harassing him to no end. I mean, they would be outside of his house when he came out in the morning to get on the bus. They would be places. They would be there when he got off the bus. They would be at his work. They would, you know, they harassed him, and he ended up dropping the complaint because, you know, they took it to him, and they think they can get away with that. And I mean, I think the Justice Department, though, has to. This is like a nationwide crisis where the police in this country are just out of control, and they're just, you know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if one of them drove right up here on the curb right now and came after me. And it just seems that they're just so fearless and shameless and you know, heartless and whatever. I mean,
this far I will go, Dave. They are a product of our brutally paranoid culture.
Yeah, 10 years of war. That's what does to the morals of a country.
Well, remember a lot, and we don't necessarily know it about this officer in question, but remember, a lot of police officers went over and participated in the slaughter in Iraq and the illegal war in Afghanistan. And so they bring those issues back, too. Not saying this officer did, but then, you know, that attitude spreads. And you've got the militarization of the police as a separate standalone issue. And then add into this the fact that the NRA has been screaming for everybody to get their guns, you know, so they can protect freedom. And you've got a perfect toxic stew that breeds these sorts of incidents.
Yeah. I know it's turning a lot of people militant, though, too. A lot of the citizenry is just so pissed about this stuff, and it's just really guys should write a book on how to destroy a society by the NRA.
Right. Well, actually, there's a book out now. Dr. Bill spent considerable length on it a week or so ago, laying out chapter and verse of everything that this cretin, Mark Levin, the man with a face made for print, or the man with a voice made for print, I ruined my own tagline, he's put it out there exactly how he wants to see the right wing dismantle constitutional self-government in this country. And it's not an academic exercise, Dave. It's for real. And they're not kidding. They're tired of living under the jackbooted dictatorship of the poors, the way they think about it, and the useless eaters, and the olds. And this needs to be a wonderland for so-called free market or Randian anarcho-capitalism to run roughshod over everyone and anything that anyone that gets in their way, because freedom.
Freedom.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just I don't know where this is going. I try to think ahead a little bit. A year or 5 years, whatever. I don't know how. I don't know what to think. How can turn things around? How to turn things around? You know, there's a way. You got to do it. You got to turn things around. But seems like Holder is not up for it, not up to the task. But
I don't. But in an imperial state, I don't know if anyone is. I don't think. And this is not the defending Eric Holder hour, because I don't think we've ever had that program here. But this is, and it's something that I guess I have a hard time explaining, but this is an imperial state. And empires behave in a certain fashion. And empires devolve toward authoritarian dictatorial conduct, which the outrageous police conduct is a manifestation of. You see, does that make any sense to you?
Yeah. It's just you know, this stuff happens slowly, and then it's just like, I think since Obama was elected, it's just a lot has been just come out from undercover, and it seems like it gets more outrageous by the day. But we still have access to the media, and I think most people are down with the farce of the mainstream, quote unquote mainstream, the old, you know, networks and all that. Anybody that believes that is, a lot of people do, but I think that, you know, I think ordinary people have more access to information. I mean, I never would have found you if I had not listened to Malloy, which, you know, when he got cut off of local radio over here, that's when I started listening online. Then I started getting your show, and then, you know, it's just like you have access to a lot more information nowadays, too, if you want the information, if you're not brainwashed. And I think a lot of people are just, you know, they're outraged about what's going on. Anybody in our age group, you know, in their baby boomers, anything like that, they've got to know that, you know, this is just, what's going on is just over the top. It's almost like these people have just gone out insane themselves. The elites have just all gone insane, or they're
no, they're not insane. They are pursuing a very real, very well-defined strategy of eliminating the last vestiges of self-government.
Yeah, I think it's already that's already gone, but just the way their behavior, I guess I don't know, maybe they're just showing their power now, but things ain't like they used to be. That's all I know. I could never have imagined. Well, I mean, you know, this is going to sound really crazy, but my brother's a libertarian, you know.
No.
And he's a creep. He's a sociopath and a libertarian and an ex-con and everything bad, nothing good. Oh, hey, you were talking about. Did I tell you that story about Lompoc? You were talking about Lompoc.
No, but I tell you what, Dave. I'm gonna let's save that for another day, because I wanna get some more folks on.
Okay, you got some other people waiting. Anyway, it was good talking with you, and I'll tell you again sometime.
All right, sounds good, Dave. You have a good evening. Thanks for the call.
Talk to you soon.
Bye now. And we are joined now from the UK by Steve, first time caller. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. Steve? Stand by, Steve. Are you there now, Steve? Steve from the UK. Stand by, trying to get Steve on. We'll try Steve in a minute, just to maybe he stepped away from his Skype. Sorry, multitasking here. Other lines open. This is where an engineer would come in handy. Hopefully we will we'll hear from Steve in a minute. At any rate, okay, he says he's going to check his systems and call back. I want to go ahead and thank let me say this real quick. I am conflicted when we have stories like the Shulers on, where you know people are badly in need, because it's in those moments that I wish that maybe we were selling Swedish mattresses on which people drop bowling balls that have grown hair with an herbal hair growth remedy and then were subsequently picked up by vacuum cleaners that were purchased with the gold that somebody bought from Buy Gold Now. Because then I would be able to simply contribute. On the other hand, we're not. And, you know, we got Monday's fundraising taken care of on Tuesday, and that left Tuesday together. So we entered the evening trying to raise $300. I deliberately did not say anything about that during the first 2 hours of the program. And not saying anything, I got the typical response. But I want to thank Ed, our buddy Ed, who still kicked in $25 to help keep us going, and went over and helped out the Shulers as well. Thank you, Ed. You have a big and a good and a decent heart. Thank you. So, yeah, we fundraise every evening. And, I don't know, maybe someday something changes that. Maybe I can figure out a way to spend maybe 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. saying something like, "Welcome to Walmart! I love you!" And then do this in the evening. But until such time as that happens, well, we survive on your contributions. Which is best done by either the traditional mails in the contribute tab at headonradionetwork.com or by using the PayPal button also at headonradionetwork.com, or you can just use my Gmail address, which is bobkincaid@gmail.com. And click the box that says personal and gift, and because we're not selling anything here. We don't even sell you the program. We don't sell the podcast. We don't sell nothing. not a sausage. So, there we go. But it would be good if we could... Anyway, it's also prayer meeting Wednesday, but I find it extremely difficult to transition away from the Shuler's story to some obnoxious story about a preacher somewhere. Except that we've got a couple of dandies. I don't want to back up for a minute, since it sort of has a tangential tie to what we were talking about in the first part of the program. But to do it, we have to go to Rochester, New York, which is pretty far north in New York State. In particular, we go to the University of Rochester, where there is a young student there named Matthew Pape, P-A-P-A-Y. Matthew Pape decided to go to the University of Rochester. He left the state of North Kakalaki to do it. You know, those Tar Heel blue skies and all of that. He left North Carolina to go to the state of New York and the University of Rochester to study. Matthew Pape has his papes in a wad. He stays in a dorm on the university campus, Matthew Pape does. And, as college students will do, set out to decorate it and make it homey for himself. Make it the place that felt like maybe he was back in North Carolina. And nothing quite says back home in North Carolina, at least to Matthew Pape at the University of Rochester in New York, nothing says it quite like the treasonous banner of the Confederate battle flag. As I've noted before, I wish some of these unreconstructed Confederates would start flying the last flag that the Confederacy flew. You know, the solid white surrender one. You might recall that Robert E. Lee arrived at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia that day in April 1865 under precisely that Confederate flag. But no, not for Matthew Pape at the University of Rochester in New York. Transplanted, poor fella, as he was from the land of decent barbecue up to Rochester, New York. He said, I'm from North Carolina, and the school is blatantly ignoring my rights to express the cultural identity I choose to identify with, even though the school prides itself on how culturally diverse it is. Matthew Pape is claiming that his rights to free expression have been violated by forcing him to remove his flag. Sure. It turns out that the Confederate treason flag was removed from Pape's room based on statements of the university, quote, after a brief and civil discussion among some of the students involved. The brief and civil discussion apparently consisted of the other students telling him to take his filthy, racist, treasonous rag down. At which point Matthew Pape done felt like he'd been violated. Poor baby. It was on October 11th when Catherine Christian, graduate house advisor, said, "It is against fire code to hang flags in your room. I will be coming by after my classes today to make sure it is no longer up." Pape, defending the flag of treason, wanted to know just which fire code was being violated by his cultural identity heritage flag. And again, Miss Christian said, "Well, you're using it as a drape. You're hanging it in your window. And that's not according to code." She then said, "I understand your flag is up out of pride. Why anyone would be proud of a blood-soaked banner of treason, lynching, racism, and whatnot. I understand that your flag is up out of pride, and you can feel free to leave it up on a wall of your room, but you can't put it in the window. Because it's causing a lot of people discomfort, and because it does not necessarily represent the heritage of the whole house." Oh, look! Democracy! How about that? Matthew Pape of North Carolina doesn't understand democracy and majority rule. But then again, his heritage didn't understand that either. Not by a long shot. His heritage, in fact, used the Senate to try to kill all mention of the vile institution of slavery. The South did. Yeah, charming, huh? He tried to rehabilitate himself by saying, on his Facebook page, "My name is Matthew Pape, and I'm the student who posted the flag in the window. I'm not a racist. I do not discriminate. That flag is used by a small percentage of people in certain hate groups, but I've never personally met a Southerner who displayed it out of hate." Good God. 150 years and the great-great-grandsons of treason still don't get it. Hey, Isaac, that video link you just tweeted to me, send it to me in an email, please. I can't get at that link here on the production computer if I want it to go on being a production computer. Richard, capital R Richard, in the chat room, noting, "Anytime you have to explain why you're not a racist, you're a racist." With Texas T also noting, "Gotta love them racist parents who can send their warped kids to college to get an education." And God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Lottie noting, "You know, if that was the University of Massachusetts, the students would have rolled that flag up and stuck it up his ass. Maybe we could invite Matthew Pape to transfer." It never goes away. And as I said, talking to Jeremy, just because it's happening in the heart of Dixie doesn't mean it can't happen somewhere else. Take, for instance, Ohio. Ohio! Ohio! Northeast Ohio, in particular. David Spondike of Akron Firestone High School. Dyke is on paid administrative leave right now. The Ohio Department of Education is reviewing the suspension based on his conduct. David Spondyke, high school teacher, is 51 years old, and he Facebooked about his frustration with trick-or-treat, which apparently came early in Akron. He said, "I don't mind if you come from the ghetto to trick-or-treat, but when you whip out your teeny word for penis and colloquial vulgar word for urinate on the telephone pole," and I would use the actual words if they weren't, I'm guessing at them, okay? They're replaced by stars in the text here. So I can't actually tell you what he says. Otherwise, this not being censored radio, I would. "But when you whip out your teeny penis euphemism and urinate euphemism on the telephone pole in front of my front yard and some preschoolers and toddlers..." Is high school teacher Mr. Spondyke, who apparently does not teach English, saying that the preschoolers and toddlers were actually urinated upon? We really don't know. "You can take your euphemism for dark-skinned people hyphen euphemism for buttocks back where it came from. I don't have anything against anyone of color, but euphemism for dark-skinned people, stay out." That was Sunday night last. Apparently, David Spondyke either sobered up or reflected upon the inappropriateness of his euphemisms and suddenly took down his post. And here's, and there's always one of these, oh my God, there's always one of these. Then he tendered a non-apology apology. "I apologize to those," this is a quote, "to those who are sincerely offended," unquote. Because apparently it is possible to be insincerely or sincerely offended. I'm merely surprised that there's not a reference in here to political correctness. I don't know. I wonder if he and Mel Gibson drink the same liquor. And speaking of racists, 28 minutes past the hour. Oh, by the way, shoot me a note on Twitter, Isaac. That link, I mean, I don't have any way of previewing it or anything. And don't play any games with old Bob. Is there dialogue we need to hear, or is it just a visual? So, please, a little help here. Speaking of racism, one of the country's premier bastions of unreconstructed racism is, of course, the National Review. You remember Jason Richwine? Rich name. Jason Richwine is the guy who penned the article for, and well, got his Ph.D., penning an article for Harvard University in which he argued that Latino brown people will always be stupid, or Latino brown people will never be as intelligent as upstanding Christian God-fearing white people. Right? Well, he lost his gig at the Heritage Foundation, but there's always a place for an old unreconstructed racist over at the National Review. Here's the quote from the dissertation. "From the perspective of Americans alive today,
The low average IQ of Hispanics is effectively permanent. The totality of the evidence suggests a genetic component to group differences in IQ. Low Hispanic IQ will be effectively permanent, even if those differences are genetic or environmental.
So he's got a new gig over at the National Review. Who is surprised? All right, this actually does have something to do. This is significant in terms of the lead story for this evening, namely the story of Rob Riley and Liberty Duke. Rob Riley. And hopefully we'll get a little cooperation out of the computer here in a moment. This is all on the fly. This is live radio. This isn't pre-produced to death. Anytime now. Anytime. There we go. Isaac tells me this is Rob Riley and Liberty Duke in a phone conversation? What? Okay, he says we need to hear it. Hopefully nobody's going to jump up with a fright mask and scream at us or anything. If you want to go find this for yourself on YouTube, it's titled Rob Riley Liberty Duke Video 2A. I wonder why he'd want that.
5204 Logan Drive.
I don't think we need to add that part in.
I said, do you know who caused me to be fired at UAB?
No.
Let's see. What is the...
I've never had an affair with Liberty Duke or anybody else.
Well, I know that you did. If I'm giving you an opportunity, if you want to make...
Phone number, buddy. What's your phone number?
You should have it showing up there. It's 991...
That's interesting. What's your phone number, buddy?
I don't know why you're upset, because you think I had you fired at UAB.
How about that? We are 3 minutes and 27 seconds into a recorded phone conversation, at which point Rob Riley, upstanding, God-fearing Christian, explains that he did not, that he was, in fact, recording the phone conversation. I don't know what the law of the state of Alabama is. Maybe you get to do that at 3 minutes and 27 seconds into a thing that you're already recording. Who knows? I think we may have Steve back from the UK on the Skype line. Are you there, Steve?
I am. Can you hear me now?
I've got you loud and clear. Great.
Oh, great. Now, I was trying to call on my Mac before, but I think my parrot's eaten my microphone, so...
Parrots will do that.
They will do that, yes.
My cat occasionally comes in and re-engineers the entire studio.
Yeah, I've had to go through a few keyboards once in a while. Misty is currently incarcerated. He's not very happy about it. I expect he will complain in a minute. Anyway, thank you very much for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I've been following, I've been following Roger's blog for a couple of years now. I'm an Englishman, and obviously I have no direct involvement with anything going on in America, but I find the whole thing, very interesting, quite fascinating, and also horrifying. The level of corruption that Roger has uncovered, and it's concerning to me because America is the only major superpower left in the world, and what goes on in America affects everybody around the world. I don't know how many Americans actually really realize this, but it's vital, you know, that you have a proper stable democracy there, and it's wilting badly. I mean, I can't for the life of me understand why it is, for instance, that President Obama hasn't cleaned out the Justice Department and the shenanigans that have been going on even since he took power.
Well, Steve, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, my personal theory on that is that this country is in a state of empire, and empires don't do that. It is beyond empires get beyond the control of any one man. For instance, consider the Byzantine Empire of, the 5th or 6th centuries up to the 13th century AD, ACE, whatever. You might have an emperor, but the emperor was not running the empire. And I think in many ways that's where the presidency is. It is beyond the ken of any one human being.
Well, yes, I think that's probably true, but the thing that bothers me is that when President Obama was actually running for office originally for the 2008 election, I mean, he was kind of indicating that he was actually going to, you know, get to the root of the corruption and get it sorted out. And then almost as soon as he comes into office, he then says, well, let bygones be bygones, and he starts making friends with the most unlikely people.
Odious, perhaps? Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, I think in talking in those terms, it also bears the famous or infamous, depending on how we view it, Steve, words of Nancy Pelosi come back to haunt us. When she was Speaker of the House of Representatives and said, impeachment is off the table.
Yes.
Clearly, from my standpoint, Dick Cheney and George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Condi Rice and the rest of that whole dirty crowd should not be running around free human beings, but should, in fact, be cooling their heels in some maximum security prison somewhere.
Well, yes, they should, but I can't help wondering if there haven't been threats made against Mr. Obama shortly after he took office.
Oh, there's no doubt of that, Steve. He is the single most threatened president in the history of the United States presidency. The threats against his life began during his campaign, not during his presidency.
Well, I mean, obviously there are always kooks and nutcases who will do that all the time, but I'm thinking he's actually having threats from within, if you like, the government. I mean, it's a bit like, I'm not quite sure how it works in America, but in England we have political parties who allegedly run the government, and then we have what we call the civil service. And it's the civil service who actually work out how government policies are supposed to run, but of course they also write policy.
Sure.
Which governments tend to rubber stamp. And I suspect that a lot of that, much the same sort of thing happens in the United States.
Well, it does, and this is in fact something that I was mentioning on the program either last night or the night before. When the Bush administration left the government of the United States, they bragged about having left moles in the civil service, deeply buried.
Sure, and the Justice Department.
Precisely.
Deeply, deeply buried. I mean, going back to Roger's blog and his coverage of Don Siegelman, I mean, that whole thing is quite mind-boggling. The thing that I find most distressing was that shortly after Obama came into power and people thought, well, you know, at last, you know, Don is going to get his situation rectified, if you like, because it was such an obviously corrupt, what would you call it? Persecution, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It was engineered by Karl Rove.
By his whole Justice Department, and they weren't just going for Don, but you know they went for lots of other people as well, mostly Democratic operators. But interesting, there was, I believe, I forget the gentleman's name, but there was also a Republican. I think he was a governor in Alaska. Was he a governor or was he a senator? But he was also prosecuted for corruption, if you like.
I'm trying to remember who that is.
He was the only one who, when Obama took office...
Oh, he was a senator. I know who you're talking about, and I can't... somebody in the chat room will remind me of his name in a minute. Mike...
Yeah.
I can't remember his last name, but Mike... His first name is Mike.
I can't remember now either. He was the only one...
He's the one who read the Pentagon Papers into the record.
Was he?
Yeah. I think they attempted to prosecute him, or maybe we're talking about. Well, yeah. Then again,
I
know what you're talking about now.
I think somebody else.
Yeah. Ted Stevens was prosecuted
Ted
as well.
Ted Stevens, that was the one. That's Ted Stevens. That's the guy. And basically, he was let off, and the only one. You know, they said, oh well, this prosecution is obviously flawed and faulty, just like. Don Siegelman's and various others.
Right, but he was told to go and sin no more. Because I don't know if you're familiar with it, Steve, but we have a shorthand handful of initials here that IOKIYAR. It's okay if you're a Republican, and that extends to, and that extends to everything from sexual deviance to political corruption to. You know, just standard day-to-day grift.
Sure. Well, I can understand that, but at the time he was there, of course, it was a new administration. It was a Democratic administration who had essentially majorities in both houses and also the presidency. And yet still it's Republicans who get off scot-free and the Democrats are left to cook.
Yes.
Why is that? How can that be? I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me. It
really
is.
among other things, there is a double standard, Steve, and it has a lot to do with the fundamentalist, what I call evangelical, because I know you're new to the program and I use a lot of funny little words. But the fundamentalist evangelical Christian community has buzzword dog whistle sayings like "not perfect, just forgiven." And so, if you are, for instance, Senator David Vitter of Louisiana, who gets caught when he's Representative David Vitter, spending much more time with a hooker in Washington, D.C. than he did with his Christian family values family, then what you do is you drag your poor wife behind you in front of behind the podium, and you say, "I have sinned, and I will never do it again. I promise. God bless America.
Oh,
I love Jesus." And they and the people of Louisiana, in turn, make you a senator. They give you a promotion, not a demotion. On the other hand...
Yeah, but that's because he loves...
Right, Jesus.
It's because he loves Jesus.
Right. On the other hand, if you are a guy who has developed a reputation for taking down big predatory financial institutions, and you get caught going to a hooker, well...
Oh, dear. I wonder who we could be talking about there. Anybody from New York, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. You're done. You're toast. Stick a fork in you.
Yeah. That's right.
And it all boils down to, it's okay if you're a Republican. Because Democrats actually have something and liberals generally and progressives generally have something resembling a conscience. The GOP does not, and the libertarians do not, and the teabaggers do not.
The teabaggers do not. I think there are possibly one or two honest Republicans. Not many.
I feel a little bit like Demosthenes walking around trying to find them. But yeah, that's entirely possible. Let me return the conversation, if I may, Steve, since we've never talked before.
Yeah.
You being in the UK, you might have a particular take on this that we here don't. Your libel laws are much, much different than ours are here in the United States. Something like what Roger Shuler was writing about, he could have been hailed into court a long time ago, could he not?
What, in the UK?
Yes.
To be honest, I couldn't say. I don't know English libel laws that well. It's not something. I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
I understand.
I know that we do have different ways of doing things. I know that our libel laws make it much more attractive for litigants to come and try their luck silencing people. If you know what I mean.
Right, right.
I don't know exactly how it works. I don't know what the differences are.
But we're supposed to have rather rigorously stringent standards to protect journalists in this country. Yes. I mean, the Constitution in the UK is unwritten. It is a matter of tradition.
I was going to say yes. We don't actually have a constitution.
Yeah, we put ours in writing. And made some rather plain statements about freedom of expression, and that's what makes this story with Roger Shuler so shocking. Regardless of which side one comes down on, for a court to impose what's called a prior restraint upon speech is, I mean, there is a line of Supreme Court cases that's a mile long that says that prior restraints on speech are presumptively unconstitutional. That means the court that imposes one is going to have to go uphill. In most cases, a court's decisions are held to be presumptively constitutional, but not with prior restraints on speech. And yet, this circuit judge did it anyway. And frankly, that's shocking.
It is shocking. I mean, it's like, particularly in Alabama, I mean, the judges write their own law. And they're allowed to do it. I guess part of the problem is that, is there any way of getting rid of your judges? I know some judges are elected, but
they are, and that's generally on the state level. But for instance, the rent boy, Bill Pryor, who sits on the federal bench, he sits there as a function of Article 3 of the United States Constitution. And he serves on good behavior. He's there for life. And that's one of the problems here, is that even if some attempt at getting justice is pursued by the Shulers, if they do it on a federal level, it will have to, well, since it's already in a state court, it would have to go to the Alabama Supreme Court, from the Alabama Supreme Court to a federal court, to a federal circuit court, and eventually wend its way to the United States Supreme Court. And because of the fact that Republican presidents since Ronald Reagan have been so monstrously effective at getting hardcore right-wing jurists onto the bench, there's no guarantee that justice will exist anywhere, as witness the prosecution of Don Siegelman. The circuit court that heard his appeal is sitting in Atlanta, Georgia, and it is the most brutal, hang-'em-high circuit court in the United States.
The thing is that in the UK, my understanding is that judges do not take part in party politics in any way. It just doesn't happen.
Ours
the nearest you get to it is...
Ours aren't supposed
to
either.
They do. Yes, but they are appointed by their pals, aren't they?
Sure.
And they are beholden to them, obviously. And obviously they're appointed also because they have the right frame of mind for the people who appoint them. In the UK we have, you know, the House of Lords, which is, and we now have a Supreme Court, which is essentially part of the House of Lords. But again, they seem really, really good at divorcing themselves from party politics. It's always surprised me, particularly with the House of Lords. You'd think that these are all people who've been many of them who sort of had their seat by inheritance, and you think, well, how undemocratic is that? And yet, these people actually take their obligations incredibly seriously. And they don't indulge in party politics anymore at all. I'm always much more confident that we can get, if you like, sensible laws, at least modified by the House of Lords, than we can from the House of Commons, which I guess is
I think, Steve, that might speak to perhaps the longer, more embedded sense of proprieties. Yours is very much a class-based culture, and theoretically, the United States is supposed to be classless, but nothing could be further from the truth.
So,
enterprising lawyers who hope someday to be—I mean, that's a sweet ride to get a lifetime appointment where you're going to draw your check as long as you draw your breath, and nobody can take that away from you, barring impeachment. And for the impeachment, you know, for the impeachment, as the old saying goes, you're going to have to be caught with either a dead girl or a live boy.
It's a little bit like also trying to get the police prosecuted, isn't it?
In many ways. I mean, there are a lot of protections for them.
Yeah. I mean, again, in the UK, it's much the same. But it's really, really hard to actually prosecute a police officer. Very often, their get-out-of-jail card is retire. Almost no matter how bad they've been, if they decide to retire, well, all their disciplinary badness, if you like, goes with them. It's only if they've committed really overt crimes that there's any chance of actually end up in jail. That happens very, very rarely. I don't know. I despair.
You despair. You despair there. Come hang, spend a little time in sunny Alabama. This is a hard case for me to see because, of course, I was born and spent the first 18 years of my life there. But at the same time, you can't run away from reality. And it's dirty it's been dirty there. And until the last time we tried to impose some sort of manifest justice and change on the state of Alabama, they had to send in federal troops. And I'm not talking about 1860.
No,
about 1960.
I mean, some of your listeners listening to our conversation might think that I don't really like America very much, and that is...
Oh, I don't think you're manifesting. I don't think you're manifesting that at all.
That's very, very far from the truth. I mean, I have such a deep admiration for many of the wonderful things that America and Americans have done. I find the whole thing so distressing that this goes on, you know.
Well, it's like watching something collapse in many ways, I think. At least that's what it feels like inside the beast. How it looks from the outside, I can only guess.
I'm not sure how many people from the outside are really aware of it, you know. I don't know.
Well, you know, we're kind of running up on being out of time. But, Steve, I hope we will continue this conversation on another day. It's always good to have the perspective of someone outside the United States who can tell us what it looks like looking outside, looking in. And if you are interested, I'll go ahead and just put a plug in here. If you are interested in issues relating to American government, we have one of the most brilliant human beings who has ever taught American history and government, and especially American origins. And he is live on the air from 4 to 6 p.m. this time zone, which I guess we'd add 5 or 6 hours to get to GMT.
Is that Eastern?
Yes, we're in the Eastern time zone.
Eastern time zone,
and we're getting ready to change from daylight savings time back to normal time. But he's on the air from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. His name is Dr. Bill O'Brien. And if you really want to get into the into the intellectual origins of American political thinking, you will be absolutely blown away by what he talks about. And all of this, of course, is available via podcast at whiterosesociety.org.
Sure. I mean, now that I've actually found you, I mean, I found you partly because of the thing with Roger Shuler, essentially because of that. I mean, I was completely gobsmacked when I heard that he'd been arrested. Not so much the fact he'd been arrested, I've been kind of expecting that. but the fact that almost nobody seems to care or know about it in mainstream American media. I mean, I just find that baffling.
I'm hoping that people...
It's something which is so fundamental.
Yeah, it is. It is fundamental. And without regard to the contents of his writing, and I think that's important to understand, it is shocking.
Yeah.
Because you don't...
It's irrespective of that.
You don't just throw journalists in prison. I mean, literally, the cases about this go all the way back to John Peter Zenger in the 17th century. In this.
But why aren't journalists screaming about this for that very reason? And they're not.
I don't know. I can only posit a theory on that answer, but I think we have someone who later in the week may be able to offer some perspective on why that is. I would think that the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Civil Liberties Union, and a number of other groups would be all over this.
Yep.
But
anyway, listen,
not yet.
Just before we go, I did have a chat via Facebook with Carol yesterday, because I was concerned for her situation, even from over here. I recognize that she is a woman basically isolated out there. And I would ask, as you have done, that anybody listening to your broadcast to please, please, please go to Roger's blogspot and press the donate button, because she needs all the help she can get.
She does. It is a terrifying situation to be in, and I know that because, well, we've been, not legally, but we have been in financial situations very similar. It'll ruin your night, ruin your day, make your hair fall out, and generally wreck your health. It really will.
I just hope that maybe one day someone will make a film about all this. They'll get something out of it, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Well, we'll be updating. Thank you, Steve, for reaching out and becoming a new friend. I hope we will have many more conversations in the future.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it. And thank you for taking on Roger's case.
My pleasure, and you have a great morning.
Thank you. Cheers.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Calling from the UK, a new friend, Steve. It's time to roll on out of here. I have to extend my kind thanks to Sal, who persistently, night in and night out, helps us keep things going here. Thank you, Sal. Sal and Ed managing to take us $35 down in our fundraising efforts for this evening. And that means we will start tomorrow with a fundraising goal of $415 for Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thanks to all of you who do keep all of this going with your kind contributions. Thanks to everyone who volunteers their time and efforts, our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org, acheact.org. That's where you go if you want to help us end the living nightmare that is mountaintop removal in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.